Good evening. I want to call this meeting to order, please. And Joe, you don't have anything. Kevin has, he wants to explain his yellow sheets. And go ahead, Kevin.
Because there's an unusually large pile of paper in front of each of you this evening, I wanted to give you the quick tour, the breakdown, identify the detritus you're seeing there on your tables. There are two stacks of yellow, canary yellow correction pages. These are the corrections for the problem that was discovered on the consolidated page for each department and agency. It was only a problem where the recommended amount differed from the requested amount. So you have corrections for each of those. It's roughly 21 pages, and there's a correction also for the Appendix C, page 3 and 4, where we there was an inadvertent omission of a couple of membership dues amounts. So those are the yellow sheets in front of you. They're in two groups because I was trying on Monday to cut my losses and get over here with a stack to get you started. And then the second round was what I got done in the meantime since then. So they're in order. So if you start at the beginning of your book at the top of the pile, you can just go through without having to page back and forth. But they're in order within each pile.
In third grade, we would say you find the page that matches your yellow page that's white, take it out, put the yellow in its place. And that would, you know, two-thirds of the class would listen and do it right. So
among the corrections, and this one isn't on canary paper, is the revised roster of county legislators with corrected email addresses, or up to date as best as we could. And then you'll also find your usual pile of printouts of tonight's presentations.
Good enough. Thank you, Kevin. We up first is workforce, and they're on their OTRs are on chapter 4, page 279, and their OTR is numbered 79. Welcome, ladies.
Okay. Thank you. We'll start with introductions. I'm Diane Braddock. I've been in Tompkins County for about 28 years now. I'm a Caroline resident and in District 7.
I'm Julia Maddock. I'm the Workforce Development Board Director and have been with the county since 2004. So Diane is actually going to start our presentation tonight.
Okay. So I'm representing the Tompkins Workforce New York Career Center. So you can go to next page.
That would be me.
That'd be you. this is our recommended budget. Our budget really is a maintenance of effort. A majority of our funding is federal still. We maintain current levels of service. We have a couple new grants that we'll be talking about. And so it really boils down to the county amount of $69,921 with local funding. And then with full-time equivalents, we've remained pretty steady over the years. However, this year we pulled one additional grant-funded half-time position into the budget, and that is a DRC, a Disability Resource Coordination piece. That's located in the center, and it's 20 hours of more intensive case management for individuals with disabilities right in the center. And at this point, we don't have any OTRs.
So I'm going to quickly jump into the Workforce Development Board budget, and then we'll go back to combining our presentation in providing just a little bit more information on what the current funding does with the what the current budget and the funding does with for Tompkins Workforce New York and Workforce Development Board. So this is the Workforce Development Board recommended budget that does include $72,059 in local funding, and that's reflected in the interfund revenues portion of your materials. The full-time equivalents for the Workforce Development Board have remained the same since 2005. It's 1.85 staff, so it's remained constant. We do have an OTR request this year in the budget, and I just want to address the OTR request and provide just a little bit of background information. I will say that the purpose that's in the book and that is we submitted in the budget does not really accurately address what the OTR is actually for. The OTR is basically the Workforce Development Board currently works with County Youth Services, and we do actually currently purchase a portion of County Youth Services staff time. It actually equates to 10 hours a week. And so we currently purchase their time to assist the Workforce Development Board with program monitoring of both the summer youth employment program. We have three contractors for that program, so they assist us with program monitoring for that program, as well as the federal WIOA youth program. And so we've been purchasing that service for a few years from County Youth Services. This OTR request is to purchase additional time from County Youth Services staff to further develop staff expertise in working with the up to age 24 population. Under the new federal legislation, WIOA, it changed our target population from through 21 years old to through 24 years old, and that has significantly changed our focus in workforce development. And realistically, we know we need to develop ongoing further expertise and be able to provide technical assistance to our current contractor for those programs so that we can increase the quality of the placements that our quality of the placements in employment and put more of a focus not just on placement but on increasing folks' hours, increasing their wages, obtaining credentials that are necessary to move up through career ladders and pathways, and provide young people an opportunity for advancement. So this OTR request is really geared toward gaining that additional staff expertise in working through that age 24. We also find that at the Workforce Development Board, it's not just the office, when I said earlier, the contractor for our programs through age 24 is actually Diane Schopp, the Office of Employment and Training. We find ourselves not just providing that expertise to the Office of Employment and Training, but through many of the youth-serving organizations and employment organizations, both the Workforce Development Board and County Youth Services being called into assisting folks with developing that expertise, and also making sure that we're maintaining the connection with private sector businesses in helping to develop those career pathways. So the OTR request, I will say that we've also requested a small amount of funding from the Park Foundation to help us to leverage these resources and our request. We also will be spending time really diving into demographics related to youth in Tompkins County up to that 24-year-old age range so that we can fully understand who is not being served by youth employment programs, who is not engaged in work, who is not engaged in education, and how do we get folks engaged in one or the other. And so we've also requested funding from the Park Foundation in order to leverage those resources. So that's the primary purposes for the OTR. Diane and I thought it best if we waited till the very end of the presentation, if that's okay with everybody, to entertain questions. So we'll move on to the rest of the presentation and then go back to questions related to any of the presentation. When we came in front of you last year to talk about our budget request, we talked a little bit about the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act being a major influence for us. It's legislation that was signed in 2004, went into effect in 2014. Went into effect in 2015, and the final regulations were actually just published about 3 weeks ago. Myself, my colleagues across New York State and the country, as well as the U.S. Department of Labor, are spending a lot of time looking at those regulations, interpreting them, ensuring that we fully understand the regulations and are implementing the law. It does have a staggered implementation timeline. There are components that had to be implemented by July of 2015, components that had to be implemented by 16, and there are additional components that have to be implemented by July of 2017. That is one of our primary sources of funding, that law is one of our primary sources of funding, and that law and those regulations are a primary source of our guidelines. The law, just really quickly, has an increased emphasis on intensive case management, we're still providing universal services. Anyone can walk into the Tompkins Workforce New York Career Center to get universal service, but there are specific populations that are eligible for more intensive services. I mentioned earlier it focuses our programs on out-of-school youth, and there's also an increased emphasis on ensuring that training available in the community is aligned with business needs. So that we can ensure we're placing folks in, training folks and placing folks in positions that are currently available in our labor market. Other major influences, currently our unemployment rate is at 4%, that has resulted in a lot more job openings available right now than we have candidates with the right skill sets. So you are hearing quite a bit about skills mismatch. That's really driving and is a major influence for us right now in ensuring, as I said, that training is aligned with business needs and that we have candidates with the right skill sets. So essentially that low unemployment rate is creating circumstances where we have employers that are fairly desperate for a workforce. Just want to highlight a couple of things related to the board and our activities in 2016 and 2017. In the previous year, we met or exceeded our state and federal and state performance measures. The Career Center served over 1,600 folks during that program year. The Workforce Development Board also contracts with three different agencies to provide summer youth employment programs. And the summer we're currently in, we served 207 youth. We also have youth programs that are providing intensive case management and working, as I said, on career pathways. Those are programs that are contracted to the Office of Employment and Training. Just really quickly, the average earnings of customers that were placed and retained in the previous year was over $29,000. It results in about $11.8 million in income coming into the community from individuals that are placed and retained from programs that we operate. And in the previous year, over $150,000 was invested in training individuals for those occupations that are in demand. A couple of other things that the board is going to be working on in the next year. We're spending a lot of time looking at who is not in the labor force currently, to have an understanding of who is not in the labor force, why they're not in the labor force, how many of them are choosing not to be in the labor force, and how can we re-engage individuals knowing that we have substantial number of jobs that are not being filled and a lack of individuals for those opportunities. So we're looking at the individuals not only that are, quote, unemployed by definition, but those that are considered not in the labor force, and how can we re-engage them. And then secondly, last year I think you heard a little bit about Advanced Manufacturing Training Survey. We have compiled the results of the surveys, had initial meetings with manufacturers, and we're moving into the next steps of that project, which is really looking at ensuring that some of the existing training programs are aligned with the needs of manufacturers. And in cases where they're not aligned, either working with existing providers to align them or creating new training programs that are aligned with those needs. We're also working with those manufacturers to ensure that they are participating and involved and a voice for ensuring that we have young people and adults as a future pipeline for advanced manufacturers. A future pipeline of young people and adults to move into those positions with manufacturers, and that's really about creating a collaborative with those manufacturers to work with school districts and others about the value of jobs in manufacturing.
And then quickly, the last four slides are really focused on the Career Center and some of reinforcing under the WIOA some of the changes that are happening. The partnership continues. It's all the local organizations and educational providers that really connect with our community in the area of unemployment and training. We have 11 partners. Each of those partners this year will be working on MOAs and rolling out a lot of the different changes with under the WIOA programs. We are transitioning and already starting to implement a lot of the programs. There's new committees, there's strategic partners, we're meeting with local businesses, and we're really, again, aligning more of the business talent needs with people who are really able to fill those needs. We emphasized already how much of the WIOA really looks at the low income, the displaced, some of the services for individuals with disabilities, and for students that don't either have their high school equivalency and or college dropouts. These are programs that we operate in connection with our partnership to be able to meet those needs. Collaborations outside of just the partnership, but really essential to our work. Our core work is working in with the Challenge SNAP program, with pre-apprenticeships, with the hospitality area, with our CU or Cornell graduate programs, and also really emphasizing a lot of what's happening now with our veterans returning, our low-income and disconnected populations. As I mentioned earlier, we have a disability resource coordination now on site that's helping people really look at how they're transitioning from high school, from college, from entering the workplace, and then also attaining a lot of benefits advisement. And then a new program that we have that's out of the Workforce Innovation Fund that's, again, not county dollars, but it's a grant program, and it targets college dropouts or anybody that has post-secondary training. And if they're interested in returning to school, there's a lot of barriers oftentimes, whether it's student loans, or they weren't successful the first time around, and really kind of getting at the assessment piece of how can we make them and help them become more successful and tap into the resources to finish college. And so that's a really great educational opportunity. We're one of nine counties across the New York State that is interested in this, and it's a national research project. And we'll have lots more to say about that in about a year. Okay. And then the last slide is talent for Tompkins. Knowing that WIOA was coming, but also knowing that the pendulum was kind of swinging back from going from high unemployment numbers to really low unemployment numbers, we really felt like we needed to get at the heart of what was happening with the local labor market. And so we developed a talent acquisition series. We've had two of those presentations thus far. The third one is coming up. The first one was really looking at data trends and challenges. The second one was really investing in how are we looking at the developing pipeline, helping us with some of those numbers. And then the final one is coming up on September 29th, and that's actually working with the community to develop solutions outside of the partnerships. So those are some of the ways, and we'll hopefully provide a summary of all of this information.
Questions. I have Peter who has his hand up, and Martha and Mike. Go ahead, Peter. Please use the microphone.
Yeah. Julia, I have a couple of questions about the training and the amount of the success of it that you showed on a previous slide. And the first question is, when you use the word training, is it sort of generic training, the kind of thing where you say you always have to come on time and so on and work hard? I don't know what else. That's true for any job. It's how to win friends and influence people, or that sort of thing. Is it that? Or is it focused towards particular job openings that you know are available? I mean, learn how to do this particular operation, okay? That's the first question.
So when I say training, I mean predominantly occupational skill training. Within the workforce, or within the Career Center and it, with our contracts with different providers, they do training on the softer skills, how to get to work every day on time. So that's a component of our contracts with them. When I say training, I'm compartmentalizing it to say occupational skill training, but we're also doing soft skills training. With our contracts with different contractors and our different programs. We do occasionally send people to, like, for example, a TC3.biz course that might be a little more soft skills related, but primarily it's occupational skills training.
Okay, if I could just expand on that question, what I had in mind. Do you look at the market of jobs that are available and then try to focus on those and trying to bring people to jobs?
Absolutely. When I say that, we have a list of demand occupations, and so when we're training individuals, when money is utilized to train folks, it has to be in a demand occupation that's in our community.
Okay, so thank you. So then I have one more question. And one way of measuring your success is to say, how many requests do I have and how many jobs do I fill? Can you make some comment on that?
How many requests do we have?
You must get people coming in saying they want help to find a job. And the question I'm asking in plain English is, what fraction of those people do you actually find jobs for?
When I put together when I put together the PowerPoint slide, I highlighted one area, which is in our performance, which is around the average wage of people placed and retained in work. Our rate of placement and retention, it tends to be around, and this is not exact because I don't have it off the top of my head, it tends to be around 70%.
That sounds very good. Thank you.
Martha.
Thanks, Jim. I'm interested. I'm really glad to hear you sort of trying to dig deeper into up to age 24 and how people are, in particular, I'm thinking about underemployment, too, so that a lot of people maybe have something, they're pulling down a paycheck of some sort, but certainly have the ability or talent, you know, to do better. What about reentry? You've named a whole lot of specific problems. Do you have anything specifically targeted for folks coming, leaving jail or prison and coming back to the community? Because that's definitely a special needs population.
Absolutely. Both the summer youth employment programs, I actually, before I left my office today, looked really quickly at data from the summer youth employment program last year and how many of the youth that we served were in any stage of the criminal justice system. And it was, for just the summer youth employment program, it was, which is 14 to 20, it was 20 out of 210 had been involved in the criminal justice system, although I tend to think that's a little underreported. The WIOA youth programs serve a much higher number in their programs of youth that have been involved in some level of the criminal justice system. It's not a number that I know off the top of my head, but it's a number that I can get access to and follow up with you on. It is a target population for the youth programs. And as I mentioned earlier, those programs have expanded up to age 24. So we're, as a result, we're going to see a much higher number of individuals that have been involved in some stage of the criminal justice system.
Well, that's great, but there are a lot of folks coming out who are older than 24, and it seems that there are specific needs. It's not just put them into the general system and happen to find out that they have been incarcerated before. So specific barriers and difficulties. So do you have anybody on staff who's really skilled in that area?
We do. The Career Center has staff that are particularly skilled at assisting people in obtaining, federal bonding. Federal bonding is something that individuals who've been involved or who've been in the criminal justice system need. Many employers will request in order to protect them in cases where individuals who haven't been involved in the criminal justice. It protects employers from potential losses related to, for example, an individual who has previously been involved in the criminal justice system stealing from them. And that is something employers will request. So we have staff on site who have a lot of expertise in the federal bonding program and provide that assistance. The staff also work very closely with Kathy Lind at the Community Justice Center and TST BOCES, who are providing high school equivalency training in the county jail. And so the staff work very closely with both TST BOCES and Kathy Lind at the Community Justice Center to provide those services. The WIOA funding that we receive, as I said earlier, is for a universal population, but the more intensive and training services are targeted toward a more specific population. So if you think of it as sort of a funnel, all these folks are coming in our door and more intensive services are provided to specific populations. When you get to folks involved in the criminal justice system, they are part of more targeted populations.
I put myself in here, and before I called on the other people, it makes sense to me, it's a comment to you and to all of us who are involved in this, that the new reentry program might, you know, need to have a stronger reach out into that group and try to collaborate with them on a different sort of basis than we've ever done before. But Mike, you're up next. Go ahead, Mike.
You mentioned that you seem to have a lot of activity, folks that have job openings that we don't have people we can match to them. Could you give me some examples of that? And what happens then if we don't have a match? Do they draw from out of county to fill them, Binghamton or Elmira or something?
Well, we hear from employers pretty regularly that they're having to draw from a larger and larger region in order to get the workforce that they need. And so, absolutely, specific examples, and maybe Diane can give a very specific example. I meet with employers on a regular basis who are saying they're not able to get the workforce that they need, and that they're having to draw from broader and broader areas. Our ongoing concern when we hear that is always that companies can't grow and expand if they can't get the workforce that they need. And there's we know that nationally, site consulting companies that are helping companies to expand are one of the first things that they look at now is available workforce. And so we're always concerned that companies make the decision to expand in another place or if they're going to create a new component to their company, that they not make the decision to expand in a different place where there is an available workforce. And so that's an ongoing issue for us.
So you're not hearing like we need a machinist or we need a computer operator or something like that, which we don't have people for?
We absolutely are hearing that.
Okay.
Will and then Dan.
My question was sort of similar to Mike's, but Julie, you talked about the skill deficit. Can you, you know, is there a small list of things that leap to mind in terms of the skills that people are lacking?
Primarily, a couple of different areas. Primarily, healthcare occupations. That's always been an issue. Healthcare occupations. I shouldn't say always been an issue. It was much better during the economic downturn, where there were more folks that had been released from their, let go from their employers, and there were a larger number of people out looking for work. Healthcare occupations is definitely an area, and if you've had conversations with Lisa Holmes, she'll tell you there are companies that are desperate for personal care aides, that are desperate for certified nurses aides. We hear from doctor's offices and healthcare providers that registered nurses are also in really high demand. Also manufacturing, it's really common in manufacturing for us to hear that there's a lack of skilled precision machinists. Welders, so skilled machinists, welders, those are, you know, the two areas that we hear the most, and solderers, uniquely enough. We have three contract electronic manufacturers in this community, and they require a really intricate skill level of soldering, sometimes on boards with microscopes. And so that's a skill level that takes a period of time to develop, and that is an area that we hear there's a lack of skilled folks for.
So,
It would be really good for us to share with you the demand occupation list.
Yeah.
That's analyzed every year, and it gets at the real heart of where are the positions lacking, where are the people that are not filling those positions. We'll make sure we get that to you. It's
okay.
A really eye-opener.
So the second piece of that is what can be done about that. Presumably some of this is at the high school level through BOCES or whatever in terms of occupations, and I assume they are very well aware of these opportunities.
They are aware of them. Would I say very well aware? I'm not sure I would go quite that far. The information has to get to all levels of the school and get in front of the classroom,
mm-hmm.
Or get in the classroom, and that's a little bit more challenging. BOCES is definitely aware of it in terms of their program design. And I will say that they are creating a TST BOCES along with Cornell are creating a new Visions Engineering program that's planned for fall of 2017 and are also working on a precision machining program that they planned to start September of 2016. But couldn't because the second biggest issue for them is finding qualified instructors. They have to have teaching certification, and they have to have that skill level. And that doesn't commonly come together.
Interesting.
And so that's another huge issue, is getting folks who've been doing this sort of work for a long time who can do the teaching to get their credential to teach.
Okay. Thank you.
And in a lot of cases, to carry it one step further, and this is a huge issue nationally, they make less teaching than they do machining. And so in a lot of cases, they don't want to leave machining for a lower pay.
A good argument for paying teachers better, I would think.
Dan.
You said that you're currently buying 10 hours a week from youth services,
yes.
County Youth Services, and you had an OTR to increase that contract. Is there a specific number of hours per week that'll buy, or is it?
It would be a total of 17.5 hours a week between program monitoring and the additional developing the youth technical assistance and expertise.
So this OTR buys 7.5 hours a week?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ludlin.
Hello, ladies. You might have said this before. I just want to double check or see what I heard. Now, there are employers, particularly, as you said, a lot of manufacturers who are having difficulties finding workforce, skilled workforce. Are there employers who are willing to train individuals? Because on my side of the world, I'm seeing a whole tankload of people who aren't able to find jobs, who are saying they're not, or they're underemployed, they're working, some of them are underemployed, as Martha alluded to. But they want to work, but don't necessarily have the exact skill set. They have something. Are employees no longer training or helping to train folks?
There are several local employers that are very committed to hiring and training individuals. I have to add to the mix that many of these employers also have shift work, and transportation comes into play because they're either not on regular transportation lines, and if they are, the shifts don't necessarily work together. So there are employers who are willing to train. We do make the attempt to get the word out about those employers that are committed to training people. There is an added challenge because, for the most part, manufacturers tend to have shift work and transportation, and childcare are that much more
right.
difficult.
But more specifically, in terms of your agencies, are you connected with places, programs that help to provide that kind of training? Or are you knowing what's out there and what the needs are, making those suggestions to places that might be interested in offering trainings And I don't know what the possibilities are, helping them in terms of exploring grant opportunities. Is that something that you all are involved in?
Yes, just a couple of examples. The HETP program right at GIAC, is Diana and I both sit on the advisory group. They've also been recently, and you're well aware, they've been having conversations about transitioning that from hospitality employment to potential other areas. Diane and I have sat down with the staff with Nagyan Laka and talked about the potential possibilities of moving into other career areas to train people. At that point, also pulled in the county and the county personnel department to those conversations about preparation for positions within the county as for civil service, as one example. But yes, absolutely, we connect with the different individuals. The reuse center, we're involved in providing services to folks that are in training at the reuse center, ensuring that they're preparing people for jobs that are available in the community and letting them know about the opportunities.
Well, Jim, may I just wrap up? So, like I said, from where I sit, there seems to be some amazing disconnect somewhere. The people who are looking for these jobs and employers who are saying we can't find individuals aren't connecting somehow. But we also have individuals who need a certain level of skill sets, whether it's machinists or welders or whatever it is. And I don't know who's offering those things anymore in the community in terms of training. So often I would send people, I don't know, maybe workforce knows, you know, if there's somebody offering welding, for example, an apprenticeship or something. So you know, I don't know what the answer is and how we sort of bridge that disconnect. I mean, I went out to watch football and have a beer the other day, and people are bending my ears. It's like, I'm just watching football, please. You know, I don't want to talk about this stuff. But folks were really concerned about individuals who they brought in for jobs, who they've recommended, but those folks don't get the jobs. And again, mainly because employers are looking for a certain skill set that you don't necessarily have, and training doesn't seem to be available anymore. But thank you. I'm done.
Martha and Anna.
Thanks again, Jim. I just want to check about the OTR, 14,688. Joe, you did not recommend this. Was this just another example of you hate kids?
No, it's not.
That's a long-standing joke. Sorry, folks.
Just my nightly disclaimer on this. Recall, I had a certain amount of target authority, directed it to the areas where we said it would be directed during their retreat. So anything above that, I've really deferred to the legislature, and these are unfunded target OTRs.
Thank you.
Anna?
So I'm thinking about training, and I know that this brings in like a whole can of worms, but there are several unions, local unions here, that have facilities that do these types of trainings, that provide apprenticeships. Is there any coordination with the unions? So what is that relationship? Because I know that, for example, the plumbers and steam fitters, they train in soldering, they train in welding, that could fill these positions. Are you guys helping and coordinating all of that? And where is that going?
We assist the plumbers and steam fitters as well as many of the other unions with recruitment. They train individuals for positions within on the job and for positions for their union membership. But don't train individuals for positions that are not union positions.
Yeah,
for their membership.
And that's why I guess it was sort of a can of worms. I'm not even sure if it's possible. It's just unfortunate that they have these facilities and they provide the training, but then won't necessarily want their members or graduates to fill the positions that are there. I'm trying to wrap that into my head, how potentially you guys could serve in some way of connecting or collaborating or bridging gaps or?
Yeah, the past two years we've also done career fairs specifically for the trades to in order to have people come in and say, what are all the different levels of trades? What are the training? How can I get started? What if I get started and want to change direction, choose a different pathway? So we're really working with the unions and the apprenticeship program in order to kind of better match those.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Anyone else? Julie.
Thanks. On page B14, there is reference to an AmeriCorps intern. I don't remember seeing that before. Have you had them before?
Yeah, we've been really fortunate over the last year and a half to have an AmeriCorps. She's been absolutely amazing, been able to provide direct service to all of what we call our resource room participants. Anybody who walks in, so our walk-ins get better served as a result of her service.
Where does that dollar figure show up in your regular budget?
Subcontracted services. I know it's in Diane's budget. So in the Career Center budget under subcontracted services, it's a contract that we have with the Institute for Human. I can't remember the entire name of it. It's an institute.
Human Services.
Institute for Human Services and
out of Elmira.
This is our second AmeriCorps participant we're utilizing right now.
If one of you could show me which page it's on at some point, you don't have to do it now. But.
We can follow up with an email to point out to you the pages. Absolutely.
Thank you. Mike?
I just wondered, are we doing anything special for the potential loss of the high-speed checkway employees of their jobs?
I was hoping you would ask that question. Absolutely. I think probably you all saw the newspaper article that we were having difficulty in getting corresponding with high-speed checkware. We're still having difficulty. I will say that eventually they'll need to issue a WARN notice once that WARN notice is issued. And we have more concrete information on what's going to occur. We will be providing services to the individuals being laid off from high speed. We're already looking at additional sources of funding. It's 185 people. If all of those folks make the decision not to move with the company, we're still trying to figure out how many people. Are people going to be offered the option to move with the company? How many people will make the decision to move with the company? But with an additional 185 people needing really specific services, we're searching out. There are federal sources, emergency dislocated worker sources of funding available, as well as state level. And then we'll also be submitting a Trade Act petition on behalf of the workers. And that also, if we're successful, results in a substantial amount of funding to retrain people from high speed.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. TCAD is next. I'm sorry, Mike, but your time is up, so we'll be moving.
Okay. Thank you so much. Good evening.
It was like that.
Good evening.
Go ahead. Heather and Michael Stamm. Heather is here.
I'm Heather McDaniel, Vice President at Tompkins County Area Development, and on my left is my esteemed colleague, Michael Stamm, who's been president at TCAD for 31 years. Is that correct? And we are here for our 2017 budget presentation, so thank you for the opportunity. It's not going anywhere, Kevin. Thank you. And here is our recommended budget. Just as a reminder, there was a period in 2013 where our budget model was a little bit out of whack. We were relying very heavily on our fees, and we came to the county, and the county set up a task force that sort of did a white paper and looked at the return on investment and the value of the services that TCAD provides, came back with a recommendation to the legislature, which you did approve a five-year funding stream to TCAD that would provide a third of our budget. Part of our budget comes from the County General Fund, and the other part comes from hotel room tax dollars. So that's what you see there. So TCAD, we've been around for 52 years. Our mission, we are a private, not-for-profit. Our mission is we are dedicated to building a thriving and sustainable economy that improves the quality of life in Tompkins County by fostering the growth of business and employment. We have a staff of five, and I think we do a lot with our budget and the resources that we have. I talked a little bit about Transform Tompkins on the budget page. Our funding model, about a third of our budget for the next 5 years, does come from the public sector, which would be primarily Tompkins County. And your five-year pledge, I think, was what really enabled us to go out and generate $1.4 million in pledges from the private sector to invest in TCAD and our mission to improve the economy overall. So the private sector does invest their dollars in TCAD, about a third of our budget, and then the other third comes from fees for the services that we provide. When we went out to businesses to ask for a five-year pledge in TCAD, we set some pretty ambitious campaign goals around jobs, new annual payroll, and new annual investment as a result of the work that we do. In just 2 years, we've nearly met all of those goals. What we've seen in the businesses that we've worked with have pledged to create 500 new jobs, $31 million in new payroll, and almost $450 million in new capital investment. So what are some of the main things that TCAD does? We provide strategy, planning, services, and get involved in initiatives where we see a need in the community. Some of the recent things that we've been very focused on are the Energy and Economic Development Task Force, which we partnered with the county to really take a hard look at energy and specifically renewable energy and how we get to meeting some of the county's energy reduction, carbon emission reduction goals. And the task force report has been finalized and presented, and the next thing we'll be doing is working on some of those implementation strategies. We've been involved very heavily with the Workforce Development Board in this manufacturing training study that Julia talked about a little bit to get a better handle on some of those skills gaps and whether there are existing programs or we can develop programs in conjunction with local employers to provide that entry-level workforce. We also received some grant money from the USDA to do a food incubator study, which we've just completed, and the next step for that will be a food summit that we're holding out in Watkins Glen. It's going to be a regional summit to bring food producers and service providers together to talk about next steps in terms of developing a regional incubator network. One of the other things that TCAD does, spends a lot of time doing, is providing direct services to businesses. We manage the Tompkins County IDA and the Development Corporation. We manage a revolving loan fund program that has grown from $300,000 to about $1.8 million over the past 9 years. I think we have about 16 active loans right now, and about 80% of that fund is loaned out. We manage the Tourism Capital Grants Program for the county, which really provides feasibility and capital resources for cultural entities in the community that are serving not only visitors but also our residents. Near and dear to my heart is the Empire Zones program. I was hired 10 years ago to manage that tax incentive program. We still have about 36 businesses that are receiving some nice state incentives to help them remain globally competitive in a local market. We also provide a lot of resources to companies, acting as a conduit to other programs. Over the past couple of years, we've spent a lot of time with businesses helping them access state grant resources through the consolidated funding application. We assist a number of businesses throughout the year in accessing training dollars and accessing NYSERDA monies for energy efficiency and other kinds of improvements. Couple of examples of some recent projects last year. This was an IDA project, the Cornell University Executive MBA program. A private developer is developing this building up in College Town, and it's going to bring 350 employees plus MBA students that are coming for a week at a time here and there throughout the year up into College Town. This project was a little different for us, but essentially what it did is it ensured that the property will be on the tax roll for at least the next 50 years. And another project, Ithaca Beer Company. We've been assisting Ithaca Beer Company since they established themselves in 1998. We did the first loan for their first piece of equipment. They just did a second major expansion, and we assisted through the IDA and also through our loan fund to provide a little bit of gap financing where the bank really wasn't comfortable with the size of the project. So they have a shiny new bottling line that will allow them to expand production from 30,000 to 90,000 barrels. Just to give you a sense of scale, they were producing about 10,000 barrels in their old facility. They grew from 10,000 to 30,000 in their new facility that they opened in 2012. In economic development speak, we call it return on investment. Some of our metrics that we look at, in 2015, we assisted 19 projects directly who project creating 206 new jobs over the next 3 years with an average hourly wage of $19.47, new private capital investment of $170 million. And here's some of the logos from some of the companies that we have worked with. Rosie, a startup company on the small side, to Seaboard, one of our larger employers, has 250 employees, just made the decision to stay in Ithaca and did a major renovation up at the South Hill Business Campus. So I'm going to end with just giving you a little bit of a sense of some of our challenges and opportunities that we see coming in the next couple of years. A real ongoing challenge is the high cost of doing business in New York State. And one of the things that we're seeing from that is the loss of manufacturing jobs. And really, it's a trend nationally, not just in New York State, but all over the country. So we're really trying to do a lot more to help manufacturers do more with less and remain competitive in a global market. And our last challenge I have up here is just a real mismatch in state funding. We've got this big consolidated funding process that the state has set up, and it doesn't really meet the needs of businesses. They're looking for growth in businesses that happens at the pace of a snail. Businesses actually move pretty quickly. So it's a lot of times infeasible for a business to say, I need to make an investment in this equipment. It will allow me to create 10 jobs. but gee, I'm planning it now. I have to apply in July. I don't get the approval until December. I don't get my offer letter, so I really know what I need to comply with until maybe June or July of the following year. And then I can go ahead and start buying my equipment. And then the state is also looking for big job creation. And having worked with businesses for 10 years in upstate New York, the real job creation is existing companies creating two or three jobs every couple of years. And if you have 20 existing companies that are doing that, that's where you're getting real growth in your community. Some of the opportunities that we see here in Ithaca is that we have world-class research and development going on right here at Cornell University. We're known all over the world for the R&D that we do. And to really, we have a real opportunity to harness some of that R&D and spin it out into companies right here in Ithaca. And the next opportunity, which is really related to that, is that we have, over the past, I think, 5 years in particular, we have developed a very strong startup ecosystem here. We've got a downtown incubator that is a partnership between all of our higher education institutions in the area. It's part of a hotspot that includes other incubators in the region. We've got the resources. We've got early stage funding. We've got equity funding right here in Tompkins County. We've got business service providers. We've got accountants and attorneys and business advisors that are all helping folks that have a good idea or a good technology to start companies. So I think we're going to start seeing some real benefit from that over the next few years. We have a very robust workforce development system, and economic development and workforce development are co-located. We work together. We spend a lot of time together meeting with businesses, talking about their needs, and, you know, we try and understand what one another are up to. Our office provides some labor market data directly to workforce. So there's a real continuity of information and services. It's not like that in most places in New York, so I think we're pretty fortunate there. And the last thing, we have a growing and thriving downtown. We've seen over, I think my last estimate was $250 million of private investment in downtown Ithaca in the past 5 years. We've got a flagship Marriott that's going to open on October 19th. No other community in upstate New York can say that. We're bringing people downtown, and that's only going to make it a more attractive place for prospective employers to bring prospective employees and new companies to come and look to attract here. So I'm going to close with that, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak a little bit about TCAD and what we do, and ask if you have any questions.
We will do that, but you left out one thing. The fifth dot should be had the very best IDA in New York State working with you.
And the best IDA director as well.
Mike? No. Questions? Martha?
Thanks very much, Heather. The downtown, I want to say the density policy, I think really the IDA's density policy was unique when we put it in place, and it's made a difference, made the difference, I think. Really gotten, it's been the seed that got this going. Two questions. One, we've already had some conversations about the Energy and Economic Development Task Force and implementing the recommendations. Now, I don't see any request in here. I've talked to Paul, to Ed Marks also, and we're going to talk about this at PDEC next week. So what is your thinking on that? What should we do, you know, if we want to actually put something in the budget to make it possible to move those recommendations along?
OTR is not a word that's in our nonprofit vocabulary. No, in all seriousness, I think that, you know, we've had some discussions with the planning department. I'm sure it'll be a discussion at the PDEC committee about implementation items and where TCAD can best facilitate that process moving forward.
And during this year, I think, as you know, the planning department came to the IDA and TCDC and received funding for several initiatives that are directly related to the
the task force. I think the navigator function is the next most important thing that we'll be discussing, how to implement that strong recommendation. Excuse me. And one of the other recommendations was meeting with the Public Service Commission, and we did have the chairwoman of the Public Service Commission in town with some key management employees of the Public Service Commission. So we've started with that recommendation as well.
So just since you may not be here when planning comes back, and can you just talk to us a little bit about what you see for that navigator, where that function should sit? And look, is it a person? Is it hiring a firm? Is that, I mean, just help us out what your opinions are on what would work best.
Well, as always, we're marching in lockstep with the planning department on that, and, of course, with Joe Mariana. Right now we're working through an iterative process back and forth with Joe, Ed Marks, and Katie on a kind of a concept white paper. So that is kind of still in process, but I think we're close to agreement on what that navigator should do and where it should reside.
Just a couple of points on that. There is a placeholder in this budget for that conversation. So the planning department put $100,000 OTR in for the navigator position. It's not funded, but again, in terms of it being a part of discussions before this budget is through, it will be through that OTR. And we are talking about ways to approach it that are different than what's been presented in the OTR.
Okay, because I hadn't gotten to that part of the budget yet. Yeah. And then the airport. I know, Michael, you're on the Air Services Board, and it's so important for, you know, especially when we bring in outside, you know, capital and, you know, investors. Where are we going with the airport? What do you see as, how's it look? In a sentence or two, you know.
That's a question you'll have for Mike when he comes, right? Martha?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But Michael's not, this Michael won't be, yeah.
No, I understand that.
This Michael chairs the Air Service Board, but I would defer to Mike Hall and what I consider to be just an incredible management team that we do have at the airport. That being said, small and medium-sized airports across the country have a real challenge on their hands because airlines are flying fewer flights, larger gauged equipment, but I think we're smarter from a management point of view and the data that we have access than most airports.
Thank you.
Mike Lane.
Really glad to hear from this Michael. Glad to hear the glowing reports, particularly downtown. You know, the shift that we did to focus a lot of help on what was a struggling city over a decade ago has really paid off. Isn't it time we started having the same kind of emphasis on some of the villages and the rural areas?
We have worked with the town of Lansing to try and implement a town center plan. And we have, you know, over time, we have worked with some of the villages and some of the smaller centers. It really is a question of critical mass. In a very small place, how much spending can one generate in order to have a business be successful? We will continue to work with the municipalities when they request assistance, and we have attempted to find resources to do some larger planning studies and things like that. And the town center, you know, the Lansing Town Center, really it came down to infrastructure. They don't have infrastructure in order to have the denser development, and what they wanted to have is a new town center.
And you do work with Town of Dryden.
Mm-hmm. Julie, you had your hand up.
Yes, thanks. I did. Is the budget that we have presented from you in our budget book your full budget, or do you have a bigger budget than what we see here?
I believe the budget in the budget book is the portion that comes from the county, and that would be one-third of our budget.
So could you make available your full budget with all three-thirds and how it's used? Is that a, or being a private entity, do you not wish to do that?
Why are you looking at me? One thing I can say is that we're this is out well in front of our 2017 budget deliberations and work plan deliberations at TCAD, but I think we'd be glad to share our 2016 information with you to give you a general sense of where the funding comes from. But it is essentially one-third regional employer investment, one-third fee-based income, which is the IDA and TCDC, and one-third county government with a little bit from the city. But we can provide you with our 2016 budget and our 2016 work plan.
I did understand the third. I mean, that is covered in Heather's presentation. I don't know how it's being spent.
Is sure. So our budget would show both the revenue side and the expense side. So we can share our 2016 budget with you if you would like that.
Maybe it will help me understand you all better. As you know, I am extremely worried about preparing our economy to thrive under climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look forward to the white paper, but we can't really wait for that. Things should be happening quickly. So you know what I worry about.
Well, and I'm wondering how our budget will respond to those concerns.
Maybe I will understand things better.
Okay. I think our work plan would probably be more useful than our budget, but we'll provide both to you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mental health? Frank is in the house. And his posse. I don't know if we're going to put the mood lighting on for you like we did for TCAD, but, you know, maybe it will go down. I don't know.
Oh, it's mental health.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got the mood lighting. next year we're going to have music, you know, like flowing music.
I like it. All right. Well, thank you. Joining me is Deputy Commissioner Sharon McDougall and our Financial Administrator Betsy Doling. So the Mental Health Department for 2017, the recommended budget at the very high level, our expenditures, revenues, and the net local components there, and you see the change, local increases in part is related to a mandate increase in our bucket for hospitalizations for those that are unable to stand trial and need to be hospitalized until they are ready, as well as the increases related to salary and fringe mandated growth. So an overview of the services that we've provided. We try to provide these each year just to kind of give you a picture of the services that are happening over at the mental health clinic. In our adult unit, we've provided service to 1,177 unduplicated individuals. The severely mentally ill, 618. In our forensics unit, 130. Our children and adolescents, as well as their families, 309. And elderly, 80 unduplicated individuals. So the total served from the beginning of 2016 is 2,314 unduplicated individuals. Our continuing day treatment program has had 55 unduplicated individuals. I hope you all are aware by now that we are no longer doing continuing day treatment and have transitioned into a PROS program, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. In our health homes, or formerly our case management care coordination group, they are the folks that are now providing those case management services for Medicaid users for everything, not just mental health services, but their full scope of health care needs. And there's 634 of those. It is important to note that many of them also utilize clinic services, so there may be some duplication with the other programming, and so our total is 3,003. So some current initiatives that are going on, most of which you've heard about over the last year and a half or so as we've implemented, but they are certainly having an impact on our future, including the budget. We have created a quality assurance unit within the department, and as you can see, they're responsible for our compliance training, the utilization review of clinical records, and quality improvement projects. We have a supervisor that's leading that program, along with three positions that are associated with that, including the utilization review position that you all allowed us to create to help us make sure that we're staying in compliance, as well as monitoring and working towards quality improvement every day. We were licensed for our PROS program this summer. So we closed CDT and opened PROS. Our initial licensing visit went well. They allowed us to begin operations. Unfortunately, we had some staffing issues that sidetracked that a bit, but under Sharon's leadership, we've continued to move forward, and we are happy to announce that we have offered three positions within the PROS program that we hope to have filled by the middle of October. So we're hoping to get that back on track and up and running. So when the state comes back for our second licensing review, we'll be in good shape. We've made physical updates to the first floor, not only the security initiatives that you all funded for us, but as well as there was one-time funding associated with the PROS program that will help us be able to provide higher quality service to those folks. So those that work is still underway, and once it's completed, we will be inviting you all for a re-grand opening to our building, because we are pretty proud of all the work that has occurred. And, of course, the completion of the main reception area that I just talked about. One of the things that came out of our Office of Mental Health audit that was an issue was satellite offices with our local school districts, and we're happy to say that those are now all licensed, and we do have memorandums of agreement with the four school districts, so we are providing services there licensed as satellite clinics, as we have been in the past, but now doing it officially under the regulatory requirements that we needed to address. So we're happy to say we're in compliance there. We've also implemented our vital access program, which was to add three positions for open access walk-in intakes. You all graciously allowed us to accept that grant and move forward, and essentially what we've been able to do is bring on a social worker, a nurse, and a support staff to handle our walk-in open access program. So that way the clinicians that we had that we have employed could focus on their regularly scheduled appointments and not be pulled away to do those walk-in services. And we are meeting or exceeding all of the measures that were established for that grant to date. So we are excited that program is going very well, and we're very happy that we had that opportunity. In our health homes program, the children's portion of that had not yet transferred to health homes, so we did have one staff person that was doing intensive case management for children. That transition to health homes is happening in October, and we have actually agreed to turn over that work to Francisca Racker Center. We evaluated doing it ourselves. Children and youth is not our forte in care management, but Racker Center certainly has the capability and expertise to do that, and they were interested in taking that on. So I'm looking at it from a community perspective. It made more sense for us to continue with the adults and allow them to take on the youth and children, and Sharon has been working with them on that transition, and it should be happening relatively soon as that moves forward. So staffing changes to the department, you'll see it's a total of 3.2. Do we have another slide, Betsy? No, that's it. Okay. So there's a total of 3.2 in change. Three of those are the open access positions that I just talked about. The 0.2 was a nurse. We had a four-day work week nurse that converted to a five-day work week, as well as my position. We have moved out of the mental health budget. So that was the last kind of piece of all of this. In order to maximize our ability to collect state aid related to the public health director position, my position as well as my administrative assistant's position have been completely removed from the mental health budget and put into the public health budget. The reason for that is the state aid that comes to mental health is a finite amount, whereas the state aid that comes to public health, we get 36% after our base amount. So all of my salary, as well as Laura's, will get 36% reimbursement from the state versus half of it getting 36% and the other half getting zero on the mental health side. The state has agreed that that matches public health law and is acceptable, and it is strictly a financial mechanism to maximize our reimbursement. We have documented everything that we've done associated with that, including moving the monies and the target associated with it. So if the legislature so chooses to revert back to having two department heads, it's all documented on how they would be able to do that and make those budgetary changes to realign it. So with that, I'll take
questions. Peter.
There was a number that jumped out of the first slide you have that I found very shocking, that when you talked about the number of clients you had and you put them into brackets, there were 80 older people. And I thought that, you know, we all have heard of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and the number of degenerative diseases that come from aging. And also I know we have a particularly large elders population in Tompkins County. So I was sort of surprised that that number was so small. Do you?
So we're serving folks with mental health illnesses, generally folks that are receiving services for those type of issues are getting it on the physical health side of their care. So it's not surprising to us to see that number be smaller.
Okay. So it's a matter of where you put them. Yeah. Thank you.
Will, Martha, Rich.
Thanks, Jim. You mentioned the transition from, was it continuing day treatment to the PROS program. Can you remind us a little bit of what that means just in practical terms? And secondly, speak, Frank, just a little more on the difficulty we're having in terms of staffing that new situation.
Sure. So the PROS model is a recovery-based model. It has a different payment mechanism, and it is more centered around identifying the goals of each individual and what recovery looks like to them, and providing as much support to do that. So not only are they receiving treatment, they're also going to be working towards employment, whether that's paid employment, volunteering, or potentially continuing their education. So we have just hired an employment specialist. We have a rehabilitation specialist that we just hired as well. Again, the opportunity to work with each individual to identify what it is they want to see from their future and what their what recovery looks like for them and be working towards that. So it's a bit of a shift where continuing day treatment was more of a come to us, we'll kind of keep you busy during the day, provide some service and treatment around therapy, but mostly it was about a place to come and kind of receive some service. PROS, again, is very much more centered towards recovery and having a plan, a path, a course of action for the individuals to maximize their ability to reintegrate in the community.
So there are some individuals that have been involved in treatment literally for decades, and the potential for recovery, whatever that means, seems pretty minimal. What are you or the state doing to evaluate whether this new model actually is addressing the needs and desires of the clients?
Sure. New York State actually did a full evaluation about the continued day treatment model.
Please use the mic. You need to roll right in.
New York State did a full evaluation of the continued day treatment model. It's a model that was not considered evidence-based any longer. It was based in like a medical model approach. So after they redid that, that's when they started and created the PROS model about a little over a decade ago. They've been rolling it out across the state because it is more evidence-based. It is based in a recovery approach to care. Recovery approach to care in a PROS model is really individualized based on that person and their specific diagnosis and their specific needs. It's not a cure of mental health. It's meant to, how can you be successful while you're coping with those symptoms and in a recovery in the community, with employment, with all of those. One of the main reasons it was important to switch to the PROS model is we know New York State is very likely to get rid of the continued day treatment regulations very soon, and they have been closing across the state. So it's actually pretty proactive for Tompkins to switch over to a PROS approach in care.
Thank you.
And I think also in response to your question about the specific individuals who have been there for decades, so part of the emphasis is to look at the individual and see what other support systems are out there, what other programs are in the community already, and to really do as much linking as possible. Instead of everyone being at mental health, they'll be more out in the community and integrating. And if, you know, and sometimes the recovery they're very small steps. You know, we're going to be looking at each individual and what they're capable of.
Thanks, Betsy.
Martha.
I'm interested in, first of all, I fully support getting the highest reimbursement for your salaries that you can get. I mean, that's well done. I'm looking at the forensic group. You said 130 unduplicated individuals. Are those people who are in drug court? Is that what that means?
They are connected somehow with the legal system. So, yes, we offer groups and individual counseling as well as services to the court for evaluation purposes.
That seems low, I'll just say. I mean, I have a we've heard over the years that, you know, 80% of our incarcerated population has basically dual diagnosis, usually of mental health and substance abuse in some way. And I have a note here from a person working with reentry that she's gotten the number from Captain Bunce at the jail that about 930 people are released from our jail every year. Now, I want to confirm that. I'm not sure that's unduplicated individuals, et cetera. That sounds really high to me. But even if it's, you know, whatever the scale is. So if in fact, a lot of people who we incarcerate have mental health issues, and we're only dealing with 130, that seems like there's a lot of untreated, even if it's just depression, whatever it is, anger management, I hope we can maybe see a way to strengthen that. And the reentry program that we're embarking on now and the emphasis that we have on really connecting people to services, I hope will make a difference. So maybe that's, maybe some of those folks are just in your general population. I guess I'm just asking that we really take a look at that this year.
Sure, and we are going to, and we're actually probably going to be coming back to you within the next 6 months to talk about a mobile crisis intervention team, not necessarily for folks that are already at the jail, but trying to prevent them from getting there. The goal is to be able to respond both for law enforcement purposes as well as avoiding hospitalizations and ER visits. If there's a way for us to have access to, you know, case social workers and case management 24/7 to be able to respond to help with some of that. So we will be bringing a plan forward in conjunction with a local partner, as well as hopefully some district money associated with it as well. So we are looking at it from that preventative side. I would expect that some of those folks that come out of the jail are in our regular population as well. Our forensics unit generally deals with the folks that are required in some form or fashion to be with us.
Okay. Yeah.
I would just add that I do agree. I think we're probably not accurately counting all of the forensics, because often they end up being counted as SMI adult in our system. So it might just be how the data is being obtained. Okay. Moving forward, I think we will be correcting that.
And then the other thing was that came out of the Ithaca plan on opioid addiction was the need for counselors to be able to treat people for both sides of the dual diagnosis at the same time, that people don't come to you in silo with their problems in silos. So how is that handled with our therapists? Are they able to work with substance abuse as well as mental health at the same time?
Absolutely. That was one of the corrective actions that we've been working on all year. We have a dual diagnosis coordinator, Rich Shaw, who works for the department. He also reaches out to all the community providers. He does training specifically on dual diagnosis. We have a lot of our staff, I think it's close to 70% now, who have completed dual diagnosis training this year alone using the Center for Practice Innovation online webinars. It's a series of 39 different webinar trainings you have to complete in order to obtain the certificate. So that has been a very major focus this year, and we're happy to say a lot of our staff have completed that. Moving forward, that will be something we're continuing to do.
That sounds great. Thanks a million.
Rich.
I have two questions. Just for clarification, when you have the forensic listing, that's where a court or law enforcement has requested an evaluation? Or is it more than that?
It's a little more than that. That's part of it, but it's also if there's been mandated treatment of some sort, so group sessions, individual sessions, those kind of things.
Mandated by a court?
Yeah.
Okay. And then on your last slide, is there a transposition on your 2017 rec? Am I missing something on that number? Should it be 65.4, or is there a difference between your target and your recommend?
It's a typo.
Thank you.
Anna.
Just a quick follow-up question. So right now, I think at the jail, they have about 6 hours a week of mental health support services. So is this would this augment that service that they have, where someone is there? The mobile unit that you would put together to augment the support services that they would have there at the jail?
In the jail, no. This would be a kind of a crisis response team in the community to help reduce calls to the police department, to help avoid them ending up in the jail in the first place.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes.
Frank, not a specific question about the budget, but just a question about all that's happened in the last year or so, and tell me, you know, how you're feeling about it and where you are, and what are the things that have happened that have made you feel better about doing the job for us?
Wow.
or not.
It depends. Yeah, it depends on the day. No. I can tell you that certainly we've had our challenges over the last year, bringing in, you know, new voices like Sharon and many of the other new staff at the department, I think it's kind of reinvigorated things over there. I think we've been a lot more transparent about the issues that we have. I gave a budget presentation to the staff a week or so ago, which I think is probably the first time that may have happened at the department. So we're trying to make everyone aware of what's going on, and I think that's helping to engage them to help us improve across the board. You know, we talked about that training on dual diagnosis. That was no small task. It was a big ask of staff to try to do that while continuing to do the work that they do every day. And, you know, certainly it's a change in culture, but they accepted it, and they've really thrived in that. And I think, you know, we're probably another 6 months to a year before we get past some of the significant challenges that we've got to get addressed. But I'm really excited about the glimpses of things that we're beginning to see, like this mobile crisis intervention, like staff engaging in a wellness committee this week, our community partners working together to talk about things that they've been working on that are in the Ithaca plan and have gotten a lot of attention. So I think there's a lot of positive things going on around the mental health department and the work that we do. And I think for me, what has been most exciting is just in the last even couple of days, a couple of events that I've been to, the Health Planning Council, which traditionally hasn't really focused on mental health or substance abuse issues. They brought in the substance abuse providers from the community. We had a full room. They gave an excellent panel discussion about what recovery looks like in our community, what some of the issues are. And this is a whole new audience of people hearing about this that can bring their expertise and resources to hopefully wrap around those folks. So there's glimpses of what we all imagined could be the potential with having, you know, a single person seeing both sides of the aisle, and so that's the exciting part. And as we continue to move past some of the challenges that we faced, we're going to have more time and more energy to focus on those new and exciting things. So they're coming, and that's the part that really excites and energizes me about what we're trying to do here in Tompkins.
Thank you very much. Take 30 seconds. Health department is next.
I have a different posse from the health department.
It's a smaller.
Smaller, but equally powerful. Do I have to do something? Okay, good. I think everybody knows Brenda Grinnell Crosby. If you don't, this is Brenda. Should I wait for Jim? Ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right, okay, cool. Didn't want to get too far ahead.
You're in charge. The lights go down. You're on.
Nice. Okay. So same kind of beginning with our overall budget. You see our expenditures, revenues, and our net local. I believe the change is surrounding some mandate decreases is what is causing that to go in the right direction. Major influences for this budget. Our state aid remains relatively stable, and I think you're aware that through NYSACHO, my state professional organization, we spent a lot of time and energy advocating for additional state aid last legislative session. We didn't get any additional, but we have heard that we may have staved off some cuts because of our advocacy around that. So that advocacy continues. If you haven't noticed, the New York State Department of Health is a little busy with water issues, as were we right now. So we're not necessarily getting in the room yet on that state aid advocacy, but we're being persistent and hope to continue that. State aid, just as the county dollars that get invested in our budget, they are the foundation of public health. And there's no time more like than the present to show the importance of having that public health infrastructure as we try to deal with aging infrastructure, emerging diseases, and the things we've been seeing over the last few years. One change financially to the budget We were approached about a year ago by a group that was advocating for funeral costs. They were representing families that might need, well, we all will at some point need to access funeral services. And they approached us about our vital statistics fees, namely our death certificate fees. The maximum is set by the state, and we were charging the maximum for both the original certificate as well as all of the duplicates. So if you're not aware, typically a funeral home will tell you to get 12 death certificates when someone dies to deal with all of the paperwork and different entities that would want that information. So at $30 a piece, you can see that that's a significant cost. We were the only vitals office in the region as they presented to us, and we confirmed that we're charging the same amount for a duplicate. And they made a good case, and it was it really just made sense. The work goes into the first one. After that, we're really just making a copy. The reason that it is still $15 is it's done on special reserve paper. It does take some staff time and energy to do that. But they made a good case. We looked at the numbers, and we agreed that we probably were not in line with what our public should expect from us. So we are proposing in this budget to lower that the additional copy fee to $15 from $30. It's about a $38,000 to $40,000 reduction in fee, which is a pretty big chunk, but we feel like we'll be able to offset that with other fees within the department, that revenue that we will realize. So that is included in this budget, and it was in response to some advocacy. Community health services, we have made some changes there. We had a senior community health nurse position that had been vacant for a while. We have new leadership in that position, in that program, due to retirements, and so we gave them a few months to get settled in, and ultimately they came forward with a proposal to make that position a community health nurse and add hours to the leadership that already existed. So we're trying to put more workers' boots on the ground while maximizing the leadership positions that we already have. So that is a change in this budget as well. The fiscal target change, it is on this slide. Again, my salary and the administrative assistant were fully moved into the public health budget and removed from mental health. Our full-time equivalents, and I lost my cheat sheet. Sorry about that. We added the administrative assistant from my administrative assistant was added. So that is the one that you see. We added a small amount to create an information aid position, as well as create a senior account clerk typist to full-time. And that was using vacant FTE that we had. Did I say
other
that?
Other way around. All right. So that we had funding left in a senior account clerk typist from the CHA closure. And once we went through some reorganization in community health services, we took that funding and added an additional small percentage, created an information aide who helps do a lot of the work in the EHR project. So it kind of, again, more workers than supervisory level staff.
And then we had we added 0.4 of a FTE to our WIC program. WIC is fully grant funded, so there's no county effect there. And there was a reduction actually in 0.2 in project assistant time that we have reduced in this budget. So that gets you to the 1.51. The biggest, the one, is moving the administrative assistant, which was the newly created position that you all authorized when we combined the department head roles. We do have an over-target request in public health this year, and it is in our environmental health division. So we are requesting a half FTE of sanitarian and environmental health. We've struggled over the last few years trying to address our regulatory mandated work while being on top of all of these emerging issues as they come out. And at least for the 5 years that I've been here, each year we've said, well, next year when this issue goes away, things will settle down and we'll get back to it. And then hydrilla comes. And then we say hydrilla is going to go, and then lead comes. And then we say lead's going to go, and we're running out of water to drink. There's continually issues that are arising in environmental health that are driving the need for our senior level staff to be a part of, our environmental health director and our senior sanitarians, trying to support all of these emerging things as they come out. And so we've finally gotten to the point where we feel like we do need to ask for more help to get the day-to-day work done. I will tell you that you guys have invested in the Environmental Health Division. You allowed us to invest in a paperless initiative that we're about halfway through, which has created efficiencies. It has reduced workloads, certainly for our administrative folks, and it has opened up access to the public to that. But it's not keeping pace with the demand of the work. The number of facilities that we're serving continues to rise, and we really do need that line level support to help us manage that. I will say we have also made changes in environmental health as well. We used to have 4 senior sanitarians. We've realigned down to 3, again, in order to put more people in positions that are out in the field doing the work, trying to maximize the efficiency of our managers. So we have taken steps to try to address this additional need, but we're at the point where we do feel like we need to come to you all and ask for more. And so that's our OTR request.
Thank you. Peter, Martha.
Just one quick question about your first slide. When you talked about the $30 for the first certificate, $15 for each additional. I can see the 30. It may take a long time to make sure all the data is right, but to get the second one, you just press a button on the computer and off it comes. So it sounds like grabbing to me.
Yes, but it's not quite that simple, Peter. Just the paper alone that we have to print these on, because they are a security paper, is extremely expensive per sheet. So that adds cost. And then there is cost to us managing the office to be able to create those additional copies. So it's not as simple as we're creating widgets. It's a matter of looking at the overall operations of that program and making sure that the revenues can support the effort of work that goes into it. The reason that we look at the additional copies as an opportunity to reduce costs is because it is that place where it is a duplication of effort, but there is still the overall cost of having an office to begin with that adds cost to each copy of a birth certificate, whether it's an original or a copy.
Okay.
That's my answer.
Martha?
This is a question on page 107. And I don't know if this is something that Kevin generates or you do. It's the big list of full-time equivalents with all the positions. So your OTR is for another half-time public health sanitarium, and I see that under OTR requested. And then recommended, it says zero. But then it's, in fact, added to the total, and it's also that half an OTR. Half an FTE is in the total at the bottom of that column.
It was an error. We found it about 4 or 5 hours ago. Joe did not recommend it in his budget, but it did get transposed in. As we understand it, it does not affect the overall county number. It was a typo, for lack of a better way of describing it.
Okay. So
right,
looking at those columns, the OTR recommended should also be zero?
Correct.
And then the total should be 66.19? Okay. And then that line above is 9 instead of 9.5. Thank you.
Yeah, Martha, some of it might be attributed to the change from the old system to the new system. Ledlin, and then Mike.
Thank you, Martha. That was one of the clarifications I had. But my next thing has to do with the vital records fees. Did I hear you correctly that we're looking at $38,000 to $40,000 from fees? So could you tell me where else were you thinking, because you said, you know, there are other places where you might be able to increase fees, where else might we be able to increase fees? Because that's a chunk of change.
Sure.
To get to that.
So maybe I misspoke. Not so much increasing fees, but being able to realize that revenue through other sources in the department. So when we look at the overall target for the county, obviously we're looking at the total budget. And so we have the opportunity within the budget to look at our revenues across the department and see if there are places where I believe we're expecting a little bit more from environmental health in the coming year. I think we're also looking at more from our community health services and the billing that they do there. So it's not that we took 38 from here and put it someplace else. We took 38 from here, and then we looked at all of our other revenue sources to see where they were and make what we thought were the best estimates. And then ultimately that brings us to the target number at the end. Thank so it's not a straight one for one necessarily.
Thank you. I wasn't assuming it was, but you did say other fees and places. So I just wanted an explanation. So thank you for that.
Sure.
Go ahead. I had Mike.
I hate to belabor the point, but I'm glad to see the reduction on the additional copies because in my practice, we have to get them frequently. But I can still go over to Cortland and buy any number I want at $10 a piece. I remember when they were $5 a piece here, and the state law said you could charge up to $30 a piece, and we immediately went to $30 a piece for them. So we're still high.
We are.
Martha.
We heard, I'm trying to remember where we heard this about charging fees by credit card. Where are we talking about this?
Finance department.
Finance.
Okay. And Rick said that the two departments already accept fee payments by credit card, you and probation. And then the immediate question was who pays the, usually it's like 3% fee to the credit card company. So how do you handle that?
We absorbed it because what we didn't want to do was discourage the use of credit cards. We are actually trying to encourage that through our new environmental health system, getting people to do all their applying and payment from home without having to come into the office. So when we made the decision to go live with credit cards, we did not raise the fees to incorporate that, and we didn't add a processing fee to use a credit card. It really got absorbed into the total budget in order to try to encourage the credit card usage.
Why is it good for you to encourage credit card usage? I know, you get the money right away, right?
Well, sort of. But it's really more about staff time needed to process paper. So if someone writes a check or pays cash, that takes staff time to process it. If they pay from home with a credit card, there's no staff time associated with that. So the $2 or $3 that it might cost on a septic permit to use the credit card is more than addressed through staff time savings.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you very well.
Yeah. Sorry, Jim. Frank, you said something that maybe my brain was slow to process. Back on the question of the fees, you said that part of what you were trying to recoup was the maintenance of the office that produced the information from which, but we have to maintain that regardless, right? I mean, that's a given part of what we do. I'm not quite understanding why we're attempting to build that into a per copy use. That's just not making sense to me.
It's really the total program cost. So when we evaluate the cost of the staff time and whatever overhead costs that we apply to a program, there's a total cost for that. And then we apply fees to it to try to offset as much of that cost as possible, just like we do with a septic permit fee. We charge a fee to offset some of the cost. It does not cover all of the cost of the department. The county subsidizes that, and in this case, that's essentially what is happening. We're adjusting the fee to be more in line with what is happening around us regionally, as well as aligning it with the cost of service that's provided. One of the things that we looked at in this decision-making process is our sub-registrar in vitals also serves as administrative support for the ME program, which is something the county does pay for. And to be quite honest, we may have been offsetting some of those costs with these fees, which really isn't the appropriate thing for us to be doing. So we tried to right-size that in this instance and look at what the costs for the program were to provide birth and death certificates, and then set fees accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time. Opportunities, alternatives, and resources. And I'm going to make a change at the end. I am going to put animal control before personnel. Animal control looks pretty easy, and we'll do that before personnel.
Good evening. Thanks for the opportunity to be here tonight. I'm going to be very brief about OAR's historic programs, since I've been coming to you for 10 years now, talking to you about the programs, and we've got some handouts to give you more information on what OAR's our annual report is in there for 2015. I'm basically here to thank you for the support you've shown to OAR and our operations and the increased support you've shown us over the 10 years that I've been with OAR. We also want to thank the county administrator for including the $7,200 over-target request that we had for the increased rent. We had to move unexpectedly, and by the way, it's working out beautifully. We're loving our new space, and the location on West State Street is great. It's very accessible. Our clients love it. It's warm and welcoming, and I really hadn't realized how dirty our old space was until we got into some new clean space, so we appreciate that. We are basically here to request a huge ask. We're here to ask for $70,000 of our initial $80,000 over-target request to fund the college initiative. The Human Service Coalition Review Committee, I believe, recommended $70,000 for this. I, frankly, am shocked by how quickly this program has grown, and it's a new program of OARs. With me tonight, I have a number of people. One is Benet Rubenstein, who's been the director of College Initiative in New York City and came to me about a year and a half ago. And I said, well, let's try it. And she's been doing this work on a volunteer basis ever since. And I'm really honored also to have President Carl Haynes here from TC3, because we believe that this is going to be a unique partnership. And SUNY today, the Board of Trustees just voted to ban the box asking the question about convictions. And so TC3 has been very, very supportive of this. We have, and I also have, two students with me this evening. Jamie Coleman, who's at Empire State College, and Carlette Crow, who's at TC3. And so I'm going to turn this to Benet to give you a little overview on the college initiative, but you all have folders that give more detail, and there'll be some time, I hope, for questions.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Benet Rubenstein, and I am the director of College Initiative Upstate. College Initiative is essentially a bridge to college program from jail or prison to college. And college is an amazing experience if a person is ready after they come home, after they're released from jail or prison, because the financial aid, Pell and TAP, is based on your previous year's income. So if you've been in prison, basically you've had no income. So everybody coming home can go to college and have all of the tuition and their book expenses paid for if they go, you know, shortly after release. We utilize a participatory model. We build a learning community where each student is very invested in their own college success and where each student serves a leadership role. So the college initiative in upstate Tompkins County is modeled after a program that I founded in 2002. That program is now part of the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. What we found is that if a person goes to college after they are released from prison or jail, they rarely return to prison. The recidivism rate for people at College Initiative in New York City is 3.2%. That compares with 66.6% after 3 years, which is the national average. So, you know, the RAND Foundation recently did a study for every dollar invested in education during or after prison, you get a $5 return for each dollar spent. The heart, and when I say heart, I mean heart, because we who do this work have a passion for the work. So the heart of the work is to support and guide primarily first-generation students to gain the necessary tools to begin and complete a college education, to have access to meaningful and well-paying jobs, and to develop the skills and awareness to become leaders and stabilizing forces in their families and in our community. And as Deb said, today begins a new era, because the question that has been on the State University of New York application, which asks, have you been convicted of a felony, has prevented hundreds and perhaps thousands of people with felonies from applying. The number of hoops that a person had to jump through to be accepted in college, I think, caused two-thirds of people who started an application with a felony to put that application down and not complete it. So we're entering a new era, and, you know, that has been going on for decades. And I cannot overstate the importance of the vote that happened today in Albany, and I believe, you know, that Carl Haynes was there. The College Initiative Upstate, the majority of our students were incarcerated. 86% were incarcerated at one point or another in the Tompkins County Jail. Almost everybody is on probation or parole, and occasionally alternative to incarceration sentences. Some of our students are just starting college, and some are picking up from where they left off. Starting in October, we're going to be running a weekly college prep program in the Tompkins County Jail. In the community, we meet one-on-one with anybody who's interested at OAR's new headquarters, and we also run weekly open study halls where anybody who's involved can just drop by. We have a host of volunteers. We always have math and writing people. We also have regular office hours at TC3. In the last 9 months, with just myself as a volunteer and a 20-hour person who is here tonight in the corner, we have met with over 100 people. We have 17 students who started college full-time this fall, mostly at TC3. And we do expect that there'll be an additional 20 students in the spring 2017 semester if we have the proper staff to, you know, meet with them and to support them. Yeah, and you all have brochures, so I'm not going to go over all of the services we provide, but it gives me tremendous pleasure to introduce Carl Haynes, who is committed to making sure that all people in Tompkins County have full access to college.
Thank you, Vinay and Debbie. And I'm here with a different kind of hat on tonight, supporting this request. I got a few numbers that I just want to share with you. I had some folks do a little research for me in preparing for tonight. Over the most recent seven semesters at the college, there's been 399 people that have applied, through this program. Only 87 of those completed the application, so 78% didn't. Part of that was this moving the box action, that the SUNY Board of Trustees approved today. But I think a significant part of that also is that the process of going through all the work that's involved in registering and going through all the financial aid process is extraordinarily labor intensive. And it needs someone like Binay and others, Laura, to really be able to help these students and these people to be able to access and be able to get through that that process. Of those that complete the process, 60% actually registered, and which I think is very encouraging. If we can help people get through that initial process and get in and get registered and so on, I think there is a great deal of success. Four out of the semesters of the that I looked at, the grade point average for these students was 2.3 to 2.8. So when the students register and take advantage of the services we have, they generally do very well. And even though the semesters that I looked at, only two or three were far enough along where they really would have had an opportunity to graduate, but we've also already had three people that have graduated just in the last three or four years. So it's I think it's a worthy investment, I think, of your resources to help support more of these people coming out of our prisons and jails to be able to have the opportunity to access higher education. When they do, Binay's made the rest of that case, and I won't repeat it, but I think it's an extraordinarily social and economic benefit for our community.
I'm sorry. Are you finished?
Yes.
Yes.
I am.
You are?
You may ask questions of our students.
Yeah, we will do that. But you're complete.
Yes.
Anna, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Just a quick question. Can you break down what the $70,000 is for and the full $80,000, what the difference is? And
yeah, basically the $70,000 is for staff. It is staff two staff. And benefits and fringe, so it's for two people.
For the director and
and the assistant.
And it's part-time assistant.
It's a part-time assistant at this point. And I would like to say before we go into a lot more budget detail that Binay has really raised a lot of private funding, foundation money. I believe it's in excess of $60,000 over the last 12 months. But it was one-time kind of startup funding. None of that was drawn by Binay as salary. So
we also received funding from local foundations. We were able to buy Chromebooks and give book stipends to every student who started this semester. And so a lot of the funds we raised went directly to the students.
And not to you.
Not to our general operating expenses, yeah.
Somebody else has their hand up here. Mike, and then Martha, and then me.
I have a question, and then I'm going to say something to the students here. Is this working just with TC3 or with other community colleges?
No, this will work with any college nearby. Our area, we've worked with... we've tried Cornell, not successfully this semester. We tried Cortland, Empire State. We've just found the most warmth and welcoming atmosphere at TC3, and many of our students were really ready to start at TC3, but we're hopeful that they'll move on from TC3 to four-year institutions, a substantial number of them. Binay students that came out of the College Initiative in New York, many of them are in policy-making positions now in the city city of New York and have MSWs, PhDs, law degrees. It's very impressive.
I'd really like to hear from the students that came. Maybe you could, there's a stand-up microphone. You can sit here and just may perhaps tell us who you are and where you're from and what the experience has been.
I actually started at TC3, and I just finished my Associates in Human Services in December with a 3.89 with the presidential citation, actually. And I don't say that to brag, but I say that because I didn't think that something like that was possible for myself, coming from my background and where I came from. And, you know, I haven't had to resort to the same things that I did before going to college. And I have a job now. You know, I hadn't been able to get a job for a decade because of my criminal history. And I didn't do anything, like, I didn't hurt anybody physically. I mainly hurt myself because, like I said, I couldn't find a job for so long. And now I have a job, and I can take care of myself financially and be independent. And I'm continuing on with my bachelor's at Empire State, and I'm really passionate about this cause. Actually taking a social policy analysis class right now, which is interesting. But I know that without this education, it would just be more of the same for me. So I'm really grateful. And I wish that this agency had been around when I first started, because it would have made the process so much easier, because as a first-generation college student, school is like a different universe. I had no idea what I was doing and no one to really guide me. So I'm really hopeful for the people that are starting out with College Initiative Upstate.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
My name is Carlette, as you know. You know we hear the saying, you can't teach an old dog a new trick. I'm that old dog that is learning a lot of new tricks today. Due to CIU, the College Initiative Upstate, you know, 53 years of age. I've just been home from prison five months. Did a seven-year bid in human services, first year of college. I was just telling Vanessa, it's like a dream come true, you know. It's too real to be true. Sometimes I have to pinch myself to make this thing seem to be a reality. And this college initiative has really changed my life, especially with that box. My charge was a robbery for a can of beer. I did 7 years. And that charge stopped me from wanting to look for a job. And I know I was qualified. This program has really helped me to look at life in a total new perspective. It's not just the beginning, you know what I'm saying? I'm going farther on. As long as I can keep getting higher education, this is the avenue where I could pay back to show that I'm not a bad person. I just made some poor decisions, some bad things happened in my life. But when life throw you a lemon, what it say, make lemonade, I'm ready to drink lemonade, and I want to pay this life for it to help someone else out that does not have to encounter going back to prison. Thanks for letting me share.
Mike, did you have a question? Or
I asked a question.
You're done. Okay. Martha, Jim, and Will.
Thank you all so much. I've met Carlette. Jamie, your name was Jamie? Okay. And you've said it all. I sort of feel ashamed to ask for the statistics again. But, Renee, you said the college in New York City was 3.2% recidivism rate?
Yes, and half of that was new charges, and the other half was a violation of parole. Okay. Yeah.
And then
so
the national average is 66%.
Yeah, New York State is a little bit lower than that, but that is the national rate. Yeah.
And you said that. Carl, I guess I was confused. You said you had 399 applicants who started the application process over the last seven semesters.
Oh, that's not through the college initiative, though.
Right, I understand. Yeah.
No, that was just seven semesters, the sample that I took, the most recent seven semesters. So that was that number. And those are people that started the application process but didn't complete.
Okay, I see.
Started which application process? I guess I had the same question. Just a college application
for
process
TC3?
Period?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Just a TC3 application process is what you're referring to? Okay, thank you.
And those are folks you know had a criminal record, that's why they, or that was associated with why they didn't complete?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Did the 300 plus check the box?
Well, yeah, they're required to.
Got it.
Well, either that or they don't complete. Okay, they don't finish or they don't pursue it.
Okay, just so we know
that's been one of the major factors why I think people don't go on. And actually, our number, the point I was making with the numbers that I was citing earlier is that it's a much higher percentage of the students that we've experienced that don't continue on compared to the, you know, the 66% that's kind of the average in the I think the state.
Okay. I'm really impressed, and I, you know, thank you all for your work.
Will?
Jim, I think you were next one. You said.
Well, no, go ahead.
Okay.
And then after, I'll go after Leslie. Okay.
I would really like for us to find some way to support this. I'm not, we only have a ball number, and you may have said that, but the $70,000 that was recommended, which was less than the $80,000, is this buying like a, what is this buying, essentially?
Oh, it was recommended, the Human Service Coalition's Review Committee.
That's right, not Joe. But
not
yes.
Joe, no, yes. I didn't mean to misspeak in
no,
any
you didn't.
Way.
No, you did. You're very clear. I misspoke. But what is this buying in terms of?
What it's really buying is the backbone of the program. It's buying a director, a staff, and a modest fringe. We're at about a 25% fringe rate.
So basically one person.
Well, no, one and a half.
One and a half persons, and these would be based at OAR?
Yes, they are part of OAR. We started with just kind of a loosey-goosey yeah. kind of a relationship, and let's see how it goes. And we formalized the relationship so that the College Initiative Upstate is a new program of OARs.
Okay. And I fully understand why you would like this to be a target to have stability. Am I right in assuming that if we are unable to do that, that one time would also be something you would consider?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Leslin.
Major kudos to the SUNY Board of Trustees for that vote and moving in the right direction. And I hope many others at our state and federal level will really take that as an example, step out of the dark ages and get rid of that box that has been a barrier in a major way to people in all walks of life, not just for school, employment, rent, housing, everything, you name it. So my heart is really full just hearing that. So that is extremely good news. On the same purchase question, now like I can put a price on what it does for someone's life. As you all students have shared here with us. But if you can think of how many students, how many people do you intend to reach, or do you think that you can reach with a director doing this program?
Well, we know we'll have a minimum of 20.
A minimum of 20.
Additional to the 18 that are in this fall. And I anticipate that it would continue to, because the 18 to 20 to 20 to 25 the following fall. Mm-hmm. The word is getting out very quickly, though. It's grown much more quickly than I anticipated when I applied to the Human Service Coalition in May, actually, even.
Mm-hmm. So may I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, absolutely.
So with Lucy Goosey, you have 18 students now who are in the program. You know, so with a more solidified relationship and funding, you're anticipating a separate 20 students.
An additional 20.
An additional 20 students.
In the spring semester, and one thing that we have been doing, thanks to Laura, basically, is we've really developed a database, and we're tracking what's happening with students and how many we've reached. And I think, as Binay mentioned, there's been outreach to over 100 individuals, and now we'll be doing weekly meetings in the jail with groups to let people know about this opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, let me, couple questions. Are these basically people who've been involved in the criminal justice system? That's who you're working with.
Correct.
And Binay, are you the person who is destined to have this job?
Yes, I hope so, yes.
All right, well, you know, my question is, what if you go away? I mean,
that's one of the reasons why I want to stay, because I'm aware that this is the icing on the cake in terms of my career, and I want to train a younger person to be able to do this work. And it's been about a year that I've been volunteering, and it would make a big difference to the longevity and the sustainability of the program to actually have a staff position at OAR.
It's also why we'll take one-time funding, though.
No, I understand that. So the half-time, let me call it half-time person, would be the person you were training?
Possibly.
If you decided to...
Yeah, possibly. The other piece of it is that our numbers are really growing very quickly.
I get it.
So I'm hoping that we could also get funding from outside because of the data that we've been able to put together. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. A couple people had to hand up. Anna, Martha, you again? Okay, go ahead, Anna.
Just trying to understand the location. So you mentioned the college prep program in the Tompkins County Jail that's about to start. So is that's in addition to everything you've already been doing? What is it? What's the system that you've been in place? How have you been reaching people?
Last year in the jail itself, we met with people one-on-one. We have our posters up. We're in their book that every inmate gets. And people sent us notes through the OAR mailbox if they wanted to meet with an academic counselor. We met about 43 people in the jail, because we got notes from them. We trained about 12 volunteers who went in and met one-on-one, followed up with them. However, it became very unwieldy to organize all the volunteers and keep them up to snuff and so forth. So I proposed to Ray Bunce that we hold groups instead. And he said, yes, we will hold the groups in the GED room once a week. They'll be able to read books. We'll be able to have guest presentations. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I love all this stuff. That's what he said.
Well, that brings up my other question is, how many volunteers do you have regularly working with you, or was that a temporary thing?
We have about 10 or 12 volunteers now. Some of them are drivers. They drive students where they need to go. Some of them are tutors. We have several groups at Cornell, the students have offered to be tutors. We had an intern last spring from Ithaca College. I could see that space may become an issue soon, but at the moment, it's fine.
I'm going to go to Julie and then back to you. Julie, go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking at budget book page 5-32, under OAR, it lists three different OTR requests. Each one says priority one. I just wondered if you actually had some prioritization.
I guess I just think everything's important that we do, Dooley. I really think that the if things in May, when I prepared this for the Human Service Coalition, I would have prioritized probably our rent, which the county administrator included, the increase in rent, college initiative, and the $1,800 for wage increases to maintain the spread between public sector and not-for-profit that we've got, rather than have that spread grow. Now we've got the $7,200, so it's not priority one anymore. So I'd move college initiative into priority one.
And what we have is it's listed as 80,000. You have changed it to 70.
Yeah, we initially requested 80,000 of the Human Service Coalition Review Committee because we go through them as the process as other human service agencies do, and they recommended 70, and so we've changed our OTR to 70 to reflect what the Human Service Coalition Review Committee recommended, and we think we can make it work with 70.
I just wanted to have it clear what I'm going to be fighting for, so thank you.
Martha.
Jim just asked, was this part of reentry? This is separate from our reentry initiative, but everybody working together.
Absolutely, and in fact, we've started. I had a meeting yesterday, as Binet had a separate meeting with Davi and Lisa, who are doing the new reentry program out of Cooperative Extension, to try to figure out, they've started a scope of work, and to try to figure out where there might be redundancies, where there might be support. We've begun to do that, and they have more work to do to clarify their own scope of work, but we're definitely meeting with them on a regular basis to figure out. And one of the things that I suggested yesterday, they asked, who does OAR not reach? And we don't reach the board outs. And so if they could also do something, outreach with the board outs and let them know about what's going on with reentry programs when those folks return to Tompkins, that could be useful as well. But we're dovetailing very closely.
Of course, they are supposed to be touching each person when they first come in. So as this gets going, they will be, I assume and hope, they're at least going to have an initial intake with everybody before somebody gets boarded out.
I haven't seen that detail yet.
Okay, so I just want to say, so Laura Comar is in the back over there, and she's one of the other staff person who's been doing this work. So the bail, a separate question, the bail fund, where are you with that?
I'm not here asking for any extra money for the bail fund. We have about a balance of about $16,000 in the bail fund right now. As you'll see from this report, our bail numbers for 2015 were substantially down. They were 32, I think, is in the annual report that's in your folders. That's due to two forces, one positive and one not so positive. And the positive one is that with the requirement of counsel at first appearance at arraignment, there have been more RORs or greatly reduced bails where individuals don't need the OAR bail. The negative portion of that reduction is due to the state law that was passed 3 years ago that we kind of thought we'd be under the radar, and they've made us sign an affidavit saying that there are certain things we won't do, including bailing on felonies or bailing over $2,000. And so those have been, it's been a real chilling, it's had a chilling impact on our bail. There have been a lot of people we would have, that we think are perfectly eligible, meet OAR's bail criteria, but their bail may be set at $2,700 or $3,000 now, particularly by our rural magistrates.
Okay, and so what you talked about setting up an LLC so you could do those higher bails, is that?
I've talked about the LLC, and I talked to my board about it, and they're not as thrilled as I am about the idea of an LLC. But what they have done is Kevin Kelly, who's an attorney, has contacted the Department of Financial Services, who governs our charitable bail fund, to see what their reaction would be to that. It's a legal way of approaching an issue. I would not have done it that way. I wouldn't have asked my regulator if I could do something that's regulated by a different state agency. But this might be the best way of doing it ultimately.
You would ask forgiveness rather than permission?
That's what we did for 2 years, so.
So I just, one other question. Do you have room to expand at this in this building where you are now? Because it sounds like you're going to have to.
No, not right in this building. We're looking at the third floor of the building, and we're working with JoJo Alpern, who's our landlord, with an IURA application for single-room occupancy and additional office space. But no.
All right. Thank you very much.
Rich John, last question.
Just if you could let us know, what is your total rent?
Okay, 15 times 12 is 18,000, right? 10 times 15 is 15, yes, 18,000 per year.
Go ahead.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair. I apologize. It's a statement. I'm still pumped up from the SUNY Board of Trustees vote. And I do want to say to our folks at whatever charity's place it is, that in the spirit of positive change, we have people who are in our jails who are innocent until proven guilty, but yet we will say that you can't bail out anybody who has a felony, although they haven't been convicted. Felony charges unless they haven't been convicted. So hopefully there'll be some change there as well. See, I'm on my soapbox. It's about 8 o'clock at night, isn't it?
We will we will end with that. Thank you, Leslin. Thank you all for coming, board members, Carl, Laura, all of you. Animal Control, SPCA, major influences. Servicing cats. What? What does that mean? Sorry.
She moved personnel last.
She did.
You didn't hear him? You didn't object, man?
Because I didn't bring my notes along. That's okay.
Oh, hi, everybody. For those of you unfamiliar with the program, this is a community collaboration between the SPCA and our local residents. It's part of our overarching low-income spay and neuter program. The money from this is typically earmarked for feral cat or free roaming cat. Different communities call it different things. We call it locally a TNR program, a trap, neuter, release program. It also goes by the name of community cats in other communities. But basically, it's a portion of the free roaming wild cat population in the Tompkins County community that comes in for spay neuter services are ear tipped for physical identification, given rabies vaccination to reduce the threat of public health from the spread of rabies, and then released back into the natural environment. In terms of major influences, our program has continued to grow. This is our ninth year doing this. I do think the one thing to note, I think it's pretty obvious from the numbers that from 2011 to 2014, these numbers increased significantly. They did drop a little bit in 2015. That is basically attributed to the very severe winter preceding that year. I can tell you conversely that our very mild winter this past year is having the opposite effect on this. So we anticipate those numbers to increase, if not exceed, the higher 2014 numbers moving forward. But happy to answer any questions, certainly.
Questions for Jim. How you doing?
I'm fantastic.
All right. Nobody has any questions. Mike.
I just wondered, we hear a lot about feral cats attacking birds and other animals. And is the releasing of these feral cats the best way to maintain the natural wildlife as well?
We I mean, as an agency, we have certain beliefs that we would put forth there. I can give you some of my own personal as well as the agency's. There have been several what they call scat studies, believe it or not, showing that wild cats, the primarily in the investigation of their feces, birds are not their primary source of food. Typically, it's rodents. Typically, it's lizards, any sort of small salamanders, things that they can get their hands on more readily. Birds actually are not that easy to catch for a cat. I know we often think that, and you hear sometimes in the lab of ornithology that, you know, cats are sort of decimating wild, you know, songbird populations. There's not a lot of studies to specifically prove that fact. They seem to feed mostly, like I said again, on rodents, which is another, you know, health situation for residents as well as a nuisance species. One could also make the argument that it is that cycle of life. The cat eats the rodent, the fox eats the cat, the coyote eats the fox. I mean, it goes on and on. So without that sort of natural checks and balances, I think you'd have a disproportionate population one way or the other. So personally, again, we get a lot of we do have some negative feedback from the just general release of those cats back into the wild from bird lovers. Again, I would argue that there's no statistic evidence to support that that's an issue. We also do keep any friendly, quote-unquote, feral or wild cats, particularly kittens, are very open to being rehabilitated from those wild behaviors and then can be placed in adoptive homes. So any feral or wild cats that would come to our facility would be, we have a 10-day behavioral evaluation that we give them to determine if they are, quote, feral or friendly. And then if they're adoptable, we would adopt them out. And again, we have an entire group of volunteers specifically dedicated to the socialization of feral kittens to make them adoptable.
Thank you.
Will and Peter.
So as you're releasing these, are you dispersing them around the county?
Actually the theory or the science behind it is basically to release them to the exact location from which they came,
okay.
Typically because they have we're typically working with residents who, while they don't want to take ownership over those cats, they still recognize that there are welfare concerns with those animals and the reproduction is an issue. So cats, these type of cats want to live where they were found. We have looked, sometimes we do get property owners who just simply don't want them back, or we feel they might be at risk to go back to the particular area that they are. We don't have a lot of great data, but a lot of the follow-up indicates that they do flee from the new area, whereas if they're released to where they were originally found, they tend to stick around.
That makes sense, and I was suddenly having visions of thousands of cats being released into the lab of ornithology.
Did
not seem...
Right in your backyard.
quite literally.
Not at all.
Peter, someone had their hand up over here.
It was me, yeah. So when I read that story in the paper about the cats, I thought to myself, I walk a lot, okay? And I don't think I've ever gotten closer than 50 feet to a bird. Now, I realize I'm somewhat bigger than a cat, but nonetheless, it does seem that that's why they can fly, so they can get away.
Right.
So.
Yeah, again, and a lot of it boils down to the study of their feces, which just proves that birds are not the main source of their diet. We see most of the issues with birds in more domestic situations where you have a domesticated cat that might be indoor or outdoor, but you also have a bird feeder at home, which just lends itself to that possibility of something bad happening. But it's pretty tough for a cat to catch a bird.
It's kind of an urban, well, it would be called a wood legend, wouldn't it?
Right.
Kind of like the birds that are always killed by the 400-foot wind towers.
Right.
You know, no one's ever seen them.
Right. Those cats are fighting those birds for the rodent.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Jim. We're very sorry we ruined your evening.
No.
Have you seen Hand of God yet?
I see it Friday. I've heard wonderful things. I recommend it to everyone.
I saw the preview, but the read-through. It was amazing.
Kitchen theater. Yeah,
kitchen theater.
I'll have to see it.
Get out and get some culture.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Personnel.
Well, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Okay. So, the first slide is the standard slide that demonstrates our budget, the 2016 modified and the 2017 recommended budget. As you'll see, the percent change hasn't, been significantly different. The next slide is a new slide. I created this with the help of my team to demonstrate, the breadth of the work that we do in the office. I think it's not always well understood by folks just how much diverse work we do. So I broke it down into the core functional areas just to give you all an idea of the types of work that we do and who we serve. I won't read through it all, but in general, for the Civil Service Administration, we do serve 50 civil divisions, which include all the county departments, towns, villages, school districts, TC3, et cetera. And it amounts to a total of approximately 2,047 classified positions. So what that essentially means is that we are processing all of those transactions related to those positions from hire through termination. Essentially, we're keeping records, the employment record, the official employment record for each of those positions, and we're required by law to do that. So we have the vested responsibility to do that. In addition, we also perform human resources administration work, which is varied and includes, I've listed some of the items there, but those are some of the more commonly thought of kind of human resources functional areas. For employee benefits, we serve as active and retired county employees and also provide services for specific benefits to TC3, the Public Library and Soil and Water Division. And then under labor relations, I listed the bargaining units. Bless you. So that just gives a little bit of an overview. Does anybody?
No, we'll do the questions
we'll just
at
do
the
question.
End.
Okay.
Please.
All right. So then the next slide, full-time equivalents. There's the data here, and under the OTR, you will see a request for an increase of 0.5 position FTE. Under major influences, I won't read through it. I'll just touch on it, and then at the end, if there are any questions. We are still very focused on the climate survey results and working closely. I'm on the committees that are vested with the responsibility to target the initiatives that I've listed, many of which, fall under the realm of the personnel department. So we're extremely involved in those. An influence that does impact us are the personnel department staffing levels. Three retirements of key staff members are anticipated within the next 1 to 3 years. In looking at the summaries of the other budget reports for departments, this seems to be a very common theme. And so succession planning is one of the initiatives that, you know, my department is going to be investing more time and energy towards. I have provided some information to departments, but we'll work more closely with departments in the coming year. But it does also impact the personnel department. Additionally, we've been working short-staffed for the past year and a half. We've been down anywhere between 1.5 position FTEs for the past 1.5 years due to absences. So that's just one of the things that have impacted our operations. Labor relations, just wanted to mention that all four of the collective bargaining units are either continuing or re-entering negotiations, and the details are there. Process improvement and new initiatives. We've got several, this is just a sampling, really we have other initiatives, but we are working to finalize the automated orientation and onboarding program. Hopefully, of the position requests that we're submitting, the development of a comprehensive recruitment, a talent acquisition program aimed at attracting and retaining a highly qualified, diverse candidate pool. That is a definitely high on the priority list. While our department does do a lot of community outreach, career fairs, school events, et cetera, you know, we will continue to do so. Also, implementation and sustainment of new or expanding programs and initiatives. I put some examples there, the Ban the Box initiative, Play ID badges, reward and recognition, and there are many others. And to continue the enhancement of the county training program, strategy, execution, and delivery. And then I did write, as a major influence also, there are we're continually faced with increased legal and regulatory mandates. These come from both civil service law, but the majority really come from labor laws that are changing. And I listed many in the context there that have changed just over this past year. And with those changes, many of them, you know, involve quite a bit of work. Rick and Greg Potter and others can attest to the Affordable Care Act and the amount of work that that has caused all of our departments alone, that one law that has come into play and the various facets of it. So, you know, a primary responsibility of our department is, you know, maintaining compliance with labor laws, and they're frequently changing, and there are new initiatives and directives and parameters that we need to remain abreast of and maintain compliance with, and also achieve and maintain compliance with civil service law and rules. We've already begun to do training and outreach to the municipalities, and that is an area that we will be focusing on due to some issues of noncompliance, and you will be made aware of those in the coming months or so. So that's really the synopsis of the major influences on the department. With regard to the over-target requests, I did put a little narrative summary below each, just speaking to what the over-target requests are and why. And then I provided just some statistics, just some data to illustrate, you know, I think it's very noteworthy that in 2015, 132 county employees achieved an employment milestone. And I think that that's a remarkable attestation to the, you know, the loyalty and dedication of our employee population. As you can see by the years of service, a great number of people are choosing to spend their entire career or majority of career in county employment. So That's very noteworthy in my opinion, and that's all over 216 numbers. Oh, oops. Sorry, I thought they were 2015 numbers. Those are the 2016 numbers. Excuse me. In any event, it's still a large number, and it speaks very well of the county. I did also make note here just to show a difference in the volume of employment applications that are received and reviewed by our office. In 2015, we reviewed over 7,000 applications, and that means we actually look at each and every one. In 2010, the number was 2,000. So there's been a dramatic increase in the receipt of employment applications. That's largely driven by the automated system that was put into place. The automated online application system has made it much easier for candidates to apply. We administered 90 civil service examinations for a total of 943 candidates seeking employment. And for position classification projects, I just wanted to add that as a piece of information because that is a broad range of work involved depending on the type of classification, but we are responsible for position classification for all of the 2,000-plus, you know, classified positions that we oversee. So if a title or a job specification needs to be changed, it would fall under this realm here. So we do considerable work not only in the county departments, but also for the municipalities we serve. So.
Question. Peter, go ahead, and then I have one or two.
Okay. Just a quick question, just curiosity. When I look at your graph of underrepresented and white and unidentified,
yes.
I was curious how that data came out, particularly when I saw that unidentified was, in some cases, close to unidentified was close to a minority or underrepresented. Yeah.
Sure.
So, did you ask questions?
Yeah. So there is a question sheet, an EEO data sheet. It's actually optional. It's part of the application process. And the majority of people, I do think, fill it out because, you know, we indicate that it's anonymous.
Just break in. So you don't have to check off a box.
You don't.
That's
no.
Where you get identified from. I just
right.
wondered, okay.
So that the unidentified would be that percentage of individuals who've chosen not to complete that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amy, I have a few questions. First one. Is the OTR on reward and recognition initiative? Talk to us about that a little bit.
Sure.
And it was $10,000 going to be used rollover in the three requests.
Yes. Okay, absolutely. So it's been under discussion for quite some time that the county would really benefit from more reward and recognition initiatives. It was evident in the climate survey, and it's been in discussion in WDIC committee, steering committee, and other committees for quite some time now. So we have begun to do some of the initiatives this year. Joe, for instance, is issuing a welcome email to new employees. We are presenting retirees with plaques, recognizing their service. I listed the employees that have achieved milestone employment achievement, levels of achievement. And so they are issued a certificate, but the desire would be with this funding to ramp that program up and you know, present them with an award of some type, you know, pertaining to the years of service. Some other initiatives are, in addition to the milestone achievement awards with incremental awards at each level, annual employee anniversary cards, thanking them for their service, employee thank you card program, so that departments can do, you know, more frequent recognition of their employees. I indicated, and I came about this cost by estimating the cost of some of these programs, but the retiree recognition plaques, new hire, we would like to do, you know, like a swag bag or a welcome, you know, bag or gift bags, of, sure, so to speak, for new hires. And we've requested some giveaway items from various departments, and some have provided us with them, but not really that much, okay, not that many items. So we might have to supplement that a little bit. And then other miscellaneous recognition initiatives. We had a very successful employee picnic. So part of this funding could possibly be necessary to help fund that event next year, that type of thing.
Okay, yeah, thank you. At the last budget meeting, some of us were talking to Jackie about the EAP program.
Yeah.
And I know we left Family and Children a year ago or so. We got a new program. One of the things, a couple things about it. One, how much does it cost us, and will it be increasing for next year? And there was a feeling among some of us that we might want to reexamine the EAP and talk to Family and Children and make an effort to hear what they're doing, because it's my understanding, and I believe some other people here, that they have upgraded their system and literally are trying to do a better job than, you know, on these kinds of issues. And it kind of gave us a reason to leave a year or so ago, and maybe there's a good reason to go back to them if it's something that the money, you know, the money worked for.
Okay.
So first question, sure, what are we paying now? What are we going to be paying?
Right.
And
Their contract actually recently expired and was up for renewal the end of August.
Right.
With the group that we went with last year, ESI group. The cost has not increased this year. The proposed cost has not increased at all, even though our number of employees covered did increase by almost 30 employees. The pricing, and I don't know the figures verbatim, to be honest, but the pricing was significantly less. The cost was significantly less than what we had paid previous years through Family and Children's Services, which was one of the mechanisms which, you know, led us to explore other options. Prior to my coming on board, my understanding was Deb Prado had been investigating a couple of other resources, and then when I came on board, I took that over and I introduced this other company that was very similar to one that was being looked at as well. So we had both of the service providers come in to do presentations, et cetera. But with regard to cost, it was at least $6,000 to $8,000 or more, maybe $10,000 less for the new provider, and the breadth of services was just vast as far as 24/7, 365-day access, which was something that the family and children and family resource was not able to provide, that 24-hour access. Particularly with our public safety employees in those departments, there's often a need for services, you know, 24 hours a day. And often when people are in greatest need, it's not at, you know, between 8 and 5. It's often after hours or late night. So that was one of the reasons. The other many reasons were they offer extensive training training programs that are free of charge that we can avail ourselves to, not just employees but family members. They have on two occasions come to the county to, and they the feedback has been very positive. They came to the county to help mitigate some crisis situations that occurred in two different departments. So they're very responsive and helpful in that respect. Not saying that Children and Family Resources would not be, but really the primary differences are the vast difference in the scope of services, whereas the Children and Family Resources don't offer the online educational resources, the training resources, the 24 hours a day access to a licensed counselor, and the concierge-type services, such as legal assistance and so forth.
Yeah. But let me interrupt.
Yeah.
You said the contract ran out 8/31.
8/31.
So was it renewed?
Brooke was preparing the renewal.
It would be with Jackie.
Yeah, it may still be with Jackie Kippola.
If I'm an employee and I did something and I called the EAP on 9/5, September 9/5, I would have.
No, you're covered. Because
I was covered.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have a 30-day.
I mean, does it make sense to you that we take a look at family and children?
It does make sense that we look at what services they have available. I'm not sure we can get out of our contract at this point for this year with ESI without a penalty.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that.
But we definitely should look at, you know, I'm always interested in local service providers and using them whenever possible. So we definitely can look at what services are available. Cost, you know, may be a factor, may not, but, you know, definitely, you know, if they have increased their services, absolutely.
Leslin, did you have your hand up? Or?
I did, but I think Amy just answered because I was going to say that it's probably worth it. I think, you know, from my knowledge, I don't work for Family and Children Services. There's been a significant difference mm-hmm. in what they're offering in terms of services, and I don't know about cost. I think that probably is negotiable, but it rivals, I would say, what is being offered by ESI, mm-hmm. And of course the fact that they are local, you know, also adds to that. So it's worth it, you know, before we have to renew our contract again next year.
Absolutely.
Line,
so if time
take
and
a look and have
we can do an RFP in the whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And my other question that I didn't get to, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Human Resource Associate for recruitment. That's certainly something that some of us around the table have talked about for a long time. How do you envision that going forward? What are you looking to do there?
So we are in need of adding staff to the department. You know, I mentioned some of the mitigating factors earlier. However, the primary responsibility for this position would be to enhance our recruitment and outreach activities so that we can make every effort to diversify our candidate pool and staff. This year we did introduce some new recruitment methodologies, et cetera, but having someone, you know, really own it and have the time to devote to it would be really instrumental to the success of the recruitment initiatives. Someone with really current social media skills, et cetera. The person would also ideally be responsible for other HR programs, adding value to both the department and the county overall. So the skills that we're looking for would encompass, you know, a broad range of experience.
Okay. Leslin and Martha, go ahead.
I spoke already.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, so the description of that position is on our page 202 in section 4, and I would really like to see an emphasis on recruitment, you know, is reaching out more. So I'm a little nervous that it then sort of sounds like everything else is added to the job description too, which is like,
right,
and everything else that we can't get done. So I just want to say that.
Right. If I could speak to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the reason for doing that is, as we do with most of the job specifications that we create, it's not advisable to make it so narrow that people then are faced with being working out of title. So by incorporating a wide variety of potential activities, and in the language of the job specification, we use may a lot. You know, may do this, may do that. And really the purpose of that is to allow for an individual to cross-train and to pick up duties, you know, in the absence of other staff members. Also, as I mentioned, with three impending retirements, we do have to be, you know, working on succession planning and so forth. So a broader job specification does allow for that. But you can be assured that really the primary focus of this person, position, is to really dive right into the recruitment initiatives and, you know, work towards implementing a strategy that will help. You know, I have a background in recruitment, so I feel very well prepared to, you know, mentor and work closely with this individual.
Okay, because we don't often have sort of metrics that we can relatively easily say, okay, this is what it was at the beginning of your being here, and this is what it is a year later or 2 years later. But that graph you've got, you know, is pretty measurable, and I would like to see the numbers. I hate to say it, as the Commissioner of Corrections said, but I'd like to see the numbers move. I mean, we'd like to be able to really measure and know that there's a difference being made. On numbers, I'm going to go to a couple of pages earlier on your slides. I don't understand the numbers. Earlier. There you go. So you're asking for a half-time person, but you're at 20, you got 7.5 in 2016, 7.25 in 2017. How does half a person plus 7.25 equal 8?
It doesn't.
Kevin, yeah, that's a little miss. Yeah.
Okay.
Martha, it's 8:30 go ahead, at Kevin. Night. Girl, do the math.
I had a moment of panic about that myself and grappled with it. It's the OTR. So the change number there is from 2016 to the 2017 recommended. Mm-hmm. So that's from 7.5 to 8. Okay. The OTR takes you from their target of 7.25. It's a 0.75 OTR, position OTR, that goes from 7.25 to 8. So it's sort of the frame of reference for the change. It's the starting point is different.
Don't go there, Martha.
Apparently that was clear as mud.
Are we looking for a new half-time person or a full-time person or three-quarters?
They're adding 0.75 to an existing 0.25 to get a full FTE.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, is there? You're talking about FTE, but you're going to come up with one new person,
full-time position.
Yeah, right. Okay, Leslin.
So that brings me to my question, right, which I think just got answered. So we are not advertising and hiring for this position. There is already somebody in the department that's 0.25 that we're not going to bump up to.
No, that's not the case. The 0.25 is reflective of remaining.
Oh, y'all help me out here then.
I don't know. Kevin can explain it better.
They have, in their base budget, they have the funding for the quarter of the position.
I see.
They're asking, the OTR is for the remaining three quarters of the position.
Okay, so it will be a brand new position.
brand new position.
We advertise and recruit it.
A question I have, Amy, and Leslie, I'm going to,
I didn't do it.
Lay this off on you, but you've had WDIC for as long as I've been here, and we've been talking about these things. Is anybody from WDIC going to be involved in this process? Generally, when people get hired, we're not involved. But clearly, this is something we're trying to do, and a very specific reason. Yeah. Does it make sense to you that either Leslie or someone from the committee be involved in all that?
Absolutely. I have no objections whatsoever to having involvement of Leslie herself or someone from the committee. In fact, I am very much in favor of, a peer interviewing process, a team interviewing process, so absolutely. I think that different perspectives would be value added.
Cool beans.
Martha, you had your hand up.
Yeah, just help me here. So in 15, you had eight FTEs. Did we actually go down a half a person?
Yes, we did. The decision was made to reorganize in the department. We had lost a full-time FTE through retirement, I believe, and the decision was made to make some other changes in the department, which resulted in a request for an increase of 0.5. So we had a part-time temporary person in the department that we were going to bring to full-time, and that's been an excellent decision. The individual is really thriving, and so that is where that came from. Or Joe might have more to add on that.
It's so late, and I'll probably just muddy it up. But this may need like a bulleted little summary of what happened, because there is an evolution of those positions.
Yeah.
But as I'm looking at that chart, I'm trying to figure out work too.
Yeah, no,
but there is an evolution that began in 2015. At eight, a person left. A decision was made to take that position, bump it down to halftime, and then take the savings from that thing, that change, and increase some other salaries. So that's, again, that's why it went down by a half. And then through those other changes, it brought that effective FTE down to 7.25. So that's how that all got started. Kevin explained it really well, and this chart's confusing, and we'll bullet it out. There is currently a fragment of an FTE that exists in personnel that's vacant. We're taking that and bringing it up to full-time and titling it this new position, this new title.
So in 2017, to pay that person, it'll cost us three quarters, and in 2018, it'll cost us an additional quarter.
No. You'll fully pay.
That 2.5 is already in target.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And again, we'll bullet out how this.
Any other questions? Julie, last one. Go ahead.
I have a couple of questions, but I'd like to look at your statistics slide, please.
Sure. Yep.
Where you have a bar graph that refers to position classification projects.
Yes.
Are those projects initiated by employees in positions, or are those some that the director has initiated?
Actually, so I'll take the hit for this one, because Jackie had prepared a very beautiful, detailed graph that included four different types of classification projects. I felt that it might be confusing so I asked her to prepare it as a summary total. Position classification projects can include title, creation of a position, title changes, downgrade of a position, upgrade of a position. So it gets very confusing, at least I thought, when it's, illustrated that way to make heads or tails of what actually is entailed in each type of, work performed. But essentially, having the total figure out there, to me, that represented a basis by which to explain that for any of the classification projects, there's a rather significant amount of work involved, regardless of the nature of it, because it generally entails a review and modification or creation of a job specification, and classification study also includes a compensation study and a point factor rating. And so it just, I wanted to at least illustrate that those projects, that was the number inclusive of all types, but that most of the transactions do incorporate much of the same work.
So I would like to see Jackie's earlier version, if that's still available. And maybe I'll have questions after that.
Okay.
I had another question.
So can we email that out, or?
Well,
okay. Yeah.
I would like a hard copy of whatever it is. So you can print it out and send it to me.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. You sure will. Yep.
The OTR that deals with training, which is one time, and last year there was an OTR that dealt with training, which was also one time. Mm-hmm. I do not see a need for training disappearing, and I'm puzzled by these one-time requests. I looked at the, I guess, who you contract with for trainings, and I see that TC3 Biz is out for 2017. And I'm not sure what is planned for this training. So I'd like a little more explanation.
Okay, go ahead. So the reason that TC3 Biz is not listed in our contract section as a vendor is because in the fiscal policy, in the policies, we are not required to have a contract for training. I was informed of that by purchasing, Lisa, in purchasing. So therefore, I didn't list the dollar amount or any dollar amount with TC3 Biz under contracts. We still do business with TC3 Biz. We do a large share with TC3. I just didn't break it out in the contracts section because then it the way the budget system is, it feeds it in kind of weird to the budget.
Okay, so it's not that training that way has been zeroed out. It's no longer required to be listed under your contract section.
Yes.
And why is training continuing to be one-time requests and not a target request?
Joe will answer that.
I'm asking the department, not Joe.
Well, this was put forward last year by me and our department. We wanted to resurrect a training budget. And so we asked last year for money. We had actually talked early in the spring of last year about wanting to rebuild training. And the goal at that time was to make a target, because you're right, it is something that we want to do year after year. And last year, to meet our goals, we didn't have the capacity to bring that into target, so we decided to make it one time. That was last year. Same set of circumstances this year. At some point, we really want to make this target, because you're absolutely right, Dooley. We want to sustain this commitment. We just didn't have the target capacity to do it this year. And if you compare what was put in this supplement to training last year versus 2016 versus 2017, it's also higher in 2017 than it was in 16. In 16, that supplement was 50,000. This year, it's 70,000 and change. And because I think that's a reflection of our commitment to training. We think we owe our employees good training, good technology. It also, I think the added element that we want to do next year is to have the capacity to send our employees to their professional association conferences. So probation folks be able to go to the annual probation conference, at least the state conference. I know that many of us, when we go to, for example, NYSAC, I learned a lot at NYSAC, and we're hoping that that's an experience other county employees can have if we put enough money aside in this budget to be able to do that. So, again, at some point when we are more prosperous. It should be target, but for now it's important enough to still try to fund it, and the only way we can do that is with one-time money.
So it wouldn't be amiss to have it partly target and partly one-time over a multi-year period?
No.
If we felt like raising taxes?
Correct.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much. We are back here next Thursday night. If you have not given your cash to Ms. Covert, please do that.
So also on the table back are some tomatoes. My wife will kill me if I bring them back home, so please help yourself. And there's a lot of nice theater things happening. Jim mentioned Hand of God opening at the kitchen. This weekend is Porch Fest down in Fall Creek. And last weekend I saw the first of production of Cherry Arts, which is a wonderful walking tour, an audio walking tour, history telling of Tess of the Storm Country, which is based on Ithaca's West End. It's going to be happening again next weekend, and there's the write-ups in the journal and such, but it was good.